Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, the Ash vs. Evil Dead collection featuring incredible t-shirts and a sliding chainsaw enamel pin. They just released a brand new line of House of 1000 Corpses trading cards. The first collection of Cabin in the Woods t-shirts and pins are now available. The collection has three awesome Cabin in the Woods t-shirts and five enamel pins, which are the various monsters from the film. And on the 4th of July, Fright Rags will be releasing a whole new Jaws collection. And if you look back at the Shockwave team's picks at Texas Frightmare, you will see the entire Shockwave's crew is wearing Fright Rags. They keep us clothed. They keep us warm. We love them. So head to FrightRags.com now. That's Fright-Rags.com. And you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. So head to www.Fright-Rags.com now.
The Shockwaves crew is also super excited to announce that we are headed to Mad Monster Party in Phoenix this July. This amazing convention runs from July 13th through 15th at the Weekapaw Resort just outside of Phoenix in Scottsdale, Arizona. Mad Monster has some amazing guests lined up like Robert Englund, Kane Hodder, Lance Henriksen, and plus a ton of guests from the entire Elm Street franchise. And the Shockwaves team will be there doing a live show. Check out madmonster.com for more info, and we can't wait to see you in Arizona. And while you're there, touch Elric's face. Just touch it.
I just want to do a little shout out to a celebration at Sunnyside Cemetery hosted by Festival Obscura. I'll be there Saturday, June 30th. This is in Long Beach, California, 1095 East Willow Street. Our friends at Phantom Carriage have put this on. It's going to be a fun event with vendors, music, movies, all sorts of good stuff. So check it out. But don't touch my face.
Okay, welcome to episode 102 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galizio. I'm gonna skip the coughing man and go right to Ryan Turek.
Oh, wow. It's nice to be second this time.
Rebecca McKendry's here.
Hello.
And the Kane. The Elric Kane.
Hello.
Was that a real cough,
no,
or were
was,
you just trying to
totally
avoid?
Artificial. I was just, you know.
Just messing with us?
Yeah, I was just messing with us.
All right, fair enough.
Got to keep you on toe. 102, baby. 102.
102. Got to mix it up. And by the way, thank you to everybody that commented about last week, because I definitely thought it would have been divided, but and I don't want to jinx us and don't be an asshole now, but literally, like, unanimously, a lot of people were really blown away by the whole Tubular Bell story and what Christian did here. So,
and I think it's also a testament that we have to go outside the box for the next 100, because we've been doing this for so long.
Yeah.
Keep coming up with new ideas and try new things.
We've got some pretty cool stuff planned for the summer.
Except for tonight. Tonight we're back to a normal
interview. Tonight's a normal interview. But it's going to be an awesome interview.
Yes, this is true. So, thank you for that. Let's talk about Etheria, because that has officially happened, and we have a winner for the Stephanie Rothman scholarship.
Oh yeah, we got to be Becca's Vanna White. It was cool.
We didn't play a word.
I wanted you guys to come up and like give little speeches, and
nobody wants to hear from
us. Elric was like, but then I like got, when we got up there, I was like, I don't think they want to hear us talk. So like,
it was like Lori Petty, you know, Rachel Talalay, and now Becca. Like, what are we going to say?
So it was absolutely awesome. The night before, we did a giant benefit gala at this like swanky French restaurant in.
Elric, what happened at that swanky thing? I think you should tell this publicly.
Yes, I think everyone needs to know that. I was seated next to Stephanie Rothman.
Yes.
And we got along like a house on fire.
That's
talking
right.
about movies. So everyone who thinks we didn't get along on the show, that is not true.
Oh, no. Stephanie loves Elric.
I had bumps in the interview.
Did she touch your face?
She didn't touch my face. I really don't think she would have liked that. But no, it was fun. She actually talked to me for about 30 minutes about the origin story of Christ himself, the actual man, and how it's radically misunderstood. And I was sitting there, it was actually pretty interesting. She's cool.
Yeah, it was a fun night. I hung out with Nancy Schreiber for a while, who's a well-known cinematographer, and just met some absolutely amazing people there. We had a really good panel. The whole thing was a benefit, and so we raised a good amount of money for the scholarship. And then the next night, we had Etheria. Which is really cool because I got to be on the red carpet with Rob and Elric again. And Ryan, who we need to Photoshop into some of the pictures.
Well, Ryan, if you want to know our mischief behavior, so to shatter the illusion, what happens at red carpets is you normally hold up a sign of who you are.
Oh, yes.
So that all the photographers know. Familiar. Elric and I switched at the last minute, so there's we're hoping there's a series of photos that he is credited as Rob G. and I'm Elric.
GettyImages.com.
Plus, I had to drag them on there to begin with. Yeah. Like, they had messaged me ahead of time, and they were like, be sure to get a shot with the guys for press stuff. And then we get there, and they were like, I don't want to do it.
No, it's not that we didn't want to do it. It's we couldn't leave our drinks behind. We were put in a corner, and they're like, you can't leave this. After the line to get the drinks, they're like, you can't leave this corner.
You have to prioritize these things.
And yeah, so, I get it.
Like, you know, good men, we slammed it as fast as we could to join you on the red carpet.
And thank you for that.
Got it. And then
we looked spiffy.
We looked classy as shit.
I did watch the Etheria shorts, and I just want to give a shout out to Creswick.
We were going to talk about the stuff you said.
All right. Well, as someone who wasn't there, let me just chime in ahead of time and say, I like Creswick.
I was a judge. That was my pick.
That was my favorite as well.
Yeah, that was my favorite as well. The three of us were in agreement.
Australian-Japanese director, I just found out by looking her up.
Natalie James was the one that did Creswick.
Really thought that film was tonally is like exactly what I love in a horror film, where it's really mysterious but also dark and has a good gag at the end.
Did not see the ending coming. It's something I'd never seen before.
Yeah, no, really interesting. Kind of Lovecraft vibe. And the other one I thought that deserves a shout out was Instinct by Maria Arida, the AFI film.
Oh,
thesis.
The painting one.
Yeah,
I went home.
Oh, yeah, that was.
I looked up that actress because I was so impressed with the one who was playing the new artist, the bloodletting artist,
young girl. She looked familiar, but she's not in anything.
I went home and researched her because when I first saw her, I thought that she was the main girl from the Western segment of Tales of Halloween. Then I immediately went home, and her name is Jordan Monahan, and I loved her.
I love the older woman. I thought the older woman was really elegant, and just saying about her, it made the whole thing. It just is a very consistent, very hard to pull off tone, I think. Mm-hmm. It's very consistently bleak, but you're drawn into it. Like,
completely.
Yeah, and that was an AFI short. It's like 18 minutes long. And I think
somebody in the audience
out.
Passed out during that
segment. Yeah, I heard a big thud and a lot of people running.
There was a segment about bloodletting that even I was like, oh.
For art, basically, you know, draining blood for art and using it as kind of a, you know, as your paint, so to speak. But no, I was really impressed with the entire lineup. And I mean, every year it seems to get better and better, but like the quality of film and filmmakers and the first short, Laboratory Conditions, which was directed by Jocelyn.
And that one won.
Stamet. Yeah, that one won both the jury and the audience award.
Swept.
And I mean, it was very impressive because Minnie Driver and Marissa Tomei were in it. Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, you're like, oh, wow, they got these big names to be in this. And it had a very cool – actually, I think the guy was in Splinter.
Yes.
The dude from the movie Splinter.
And I think he's from like a big TV show.
Yeah,
he's famous. Like he's like a
– Yeah, a lot of recognizable faces.
Shea Whigham?
Yeah,
not Shea Whigham. No,
it's
no,
not Shea Whigham.
He's like the young guy with the glasses in the movie Splinter. But anyway –
Yes. Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
They're all really terrific, and I'm curious, do we know yet how we can see them? Like, does Etheria do something where the links go online?
They tour.
They tour them around. Like, they take them usually the Day of the Dead convention in Indianapolis will screen them. And they tour them around a bit because I know when I had a short with them a couple of years ago, like, it went to, like, the Tokyo Film Festival and they had an Etheria panel there. It went to Glasgow and they had an Etheria segment there. So they definitely take it all around the world. And then you can always find these shorts at some other festivals. Like, I know some of the ones that I really enjoyed, I've already noticed, are playing other festivals as well. So I really recommend checking out the Etheria Festival site and seeing what was playing there and trying to find them.
And some might be out online anyway. I mean, a couple of them, because if it said like 2017, for all you know,
I'd
might
have to
be.
Research, but I know they're all listed on the Etheria Film Night website.
Yep. Yeah.
And what about, tell us, so Liz Marshall was the winner of the Stephanie Rothman.
Yeah, and it
and
was.
And a listener of the show.
And a listener of the show, which was totally awesome and surprising. Yeah. But I do have to give a giant thanks to Blumhouse Productions, who came in and gave a nice donation to kind of help us reach our final goal on that one, which was absolutely awesome. So thank you, parent company of Blumhouse Productions. We love you. And so the winner, we had several hundred applicants, and it was really tough. Like, we narrowed it down to 25 people, and then we narrowed it down to 10 again, and then we had discussions about the 10. And we ended up deciding on Elizabeth Marshall, and she had submitted the short called What Daphne Saw. And it blew. It was between Stacey, Heidi, and I were doing the judging, and it blew all of us away. And we were like, we want to see this short made. And she just graduated, so the award money is going to make the short for her. And and she's a Shockwaves listener. Like, as soon as I emailed her and we were like, congratulations, she immediately responded back and is like, wait, you're with Shockwaves? And I was like, yeah, and the scholarship. Like, she hadn't even made the connection yet. So it was really cool. But she's just a diehard horror fan who wants to come sit in on the show sometime.
Cool.
So
sure.
She may be joining us in a couple weeks.
We don't let people listen to the show.
except Elwood. Shout out. He's
Elwood
hanging out
Walker
today.
In the house. On your shout out.
So yeah, but Etheria Night, it's always one of my favorite times of the year, and it always kind of renews my faith that the industry is making big strides, and the fact that I got to, you know, work with you guys to give away a scholarship this year was just one of the best highlights of my year.
Wow. So.
Yeah, it feels good to be on the front of these things, you know, change. It's nice. I thought it was great.
All right.
You should be proud.
Yeah.
I saw a wacky movie with a lot of people, and I think Elric has finally watched this too. Did you make it through?
Oh boy, I did make it through.
Oh wait, is this Fill My Love?
This is Liquid Sky, baby, from Vinegar Syndrome. Have we finally done it?
Oh,
we have done it.
Okay,
I'm in.
I had to create an environment to revisit this movie. I haven't seen it in 20 years.
Oh, you've seen it though. I
saw it 10 years ago on a kind of crappy DVD bootleg with like this punk rock chick. It was like her favorite movie, and she's like, "We need to watch Liquid Sky," and I was like, "Okay."
Was this like a date? That's a weird date movie.
Kinda, but not really. Again, it's 10 years ago. But so this time I was like, all right, I have a pristine Blu-ray. I need the craziest people I can possibly think of to watch it with. So of course I invited Adam Rifkin over, who had seen it theatrically. And the last time he saw it was in the theater.
Wow.
And then Natasha Crimani, the director of Imitation Girl, just because I'm like, this seems like a movie. You're all New York. And it's like a dual role.
As soon as I saw it, I thought of her movie.
Yeah, I was like, but she had never seen it. And so they came. Oh, and Josh Miller, of course, because he's always down for weirdness. And so the three of us watched it, and we were kind of blown away. Rifkin was commenting that it looked better than when he saw it in theaters. Oh, yeah.
Probably.
20 years ago. He was like, this is even better than I remember. I don't know. Dare we say if it's... It's an experience. I don't know if I could say this is a good movie by any means, but this is direct. All right, so it takes place in New York, but it's directed by Slava
Zuckerman,
who also did the score, which could be one of the worst scores.
It's so weird.
It's weird and not good, but...
And it does not match the movie.
Not at all.
Nope.
But it does feel like it was made by aliens, which fits the plot of the movie. And it took us a while to realize, because there's a main female character who is a model who's got a twin brother. And so it's totally David Bowie. Like, they're, you know,
yeah, it's all androgynous. Yeah.
And it took us a while to realize it was the same actress. We just thought, oh, did they get twins together? Wait, is that the same girl playing both roles? So there's that part of it, kind of in the New York scene, the New York heroine scene.
And they hate each other.
Yes, they do hate each other, which I thought was pretty hilarious. And I guess an alien orb kind of lands on the top of this building and only attacks at the moment of orgasm.
Yep.
Is that kind of what's going on in this movie?
That's what's going on.
And then there's like a shimmer to the, like a liquid shimmer to the people as they orgy out.
Mm. So alien heroin is a chemical that is released in humans at the moment of orgasm.
Yeah, and that part's factual. Right.
Totally factual.
Yes, that's happening.
Yes. I learned that from my
research that.
I learned that from my Come in Peace. I almost followed this up as a double feature.
It definitely felt like it could have been made in the Warhol factory. Like he would have been just sitting around going, yeah, let's make that movie. It's interesting, man. I found it to be a bit of a slog at the start because it felt less like a movie than it felt like an art scene. Mm-hmm. It felt like, oh, here is a documentary about an art scene.
But that's my favorite part.
I think it's interesting. Yeah.
You texted me a few minutes in saying, is this an actual actual movie? Or is it just this?
Is it just, well, the first 10 minutes.
The 20-minute me and my rhythm box performance may be one of my favorite sequences.
Just but wow.
But it is interesting. I mean, it's definitely a strange movie.
Oh, I just remembered. Okay. So there's also the German guy that's studying the spaceship, which literally is the size of like a shoebox on top of the apartment building. And then there's the woman who has a telescope, and they have this weird like relationship where like he's just completely clueless how badly she's trying to seduce this guy. And the other thing that's happening is basically it's kind of like that New York heroin model scene where everyone's sleeping with everybody. And I remember I came up with it. I was like, the horror of this movie is that I do not want any of these people – I don't want to see any of these people have sex with each other at all. That is what makes this movie terrifying, is every time they introduce two people. The only one – like maybe this German guy and this woman that in the apartment complex. I was like, I don't want to see them. But if anybody does, it should be these two. I'm guessing.
She looks like the nurse from Basket Case who screams. I wonder if she
That's totally, yeah. Yeah,
she really looks like it. That would be amazing if
it is New
her.
York, yeah.
But when I was watching it, I texted Becca and she told me that – and that was the part that was really frustrating because the brunette in the movie.
Me and my.
My rhythm box. I kept going, like, who is she? I feel like I know her. And
yes,
then you dropped the knowledge on me.
Yes, that is the little girl from Alice, Sweet Alice.
That's right.
And that's the only two things she's ever been in.
So I spent the rest of the movie like Wikipedia-ing trying to find out what happened to her. But I guess she moved to Seattle and had a baby and is happy.
That's it.
No twist to the story.
Alice, Sweet Alice, and that's it.
And then she's done.
She's great. In both of these, she's really great.
No, she's one of my favorite characters in this one. Yeah. I love her personality in this. And whereas the main girl just kind of seems to be angsty about everything that's happening to her, the other girl, the brunette from Alice, Sweet Alice, definitely has a lot more personality. So I love her in this. And I shouldn't say love. Love is a weird word to use with this film. I am fascinated by this movie. I want to have conversations with whoever wrote this because it does come across like a fever dream. It's nothing that I'm like, I want to watch it every night. It's more of like a weird fascination.
It is unlike anything you've ever
seen. Well, and the lead actress co-wrote it. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I think she had a big part of the creation of this. And I think I was watching the extras where she's talking about her time in that scene, and I got the feeling that it's kind of like they're living these vacuous lives. They're letting people have their bodies who they're not even into. They're just kind of like, you know, somebody shows interest, so they just kind of give it up. And she was like saying it was right on the cusp of people getting AIDS too, and a lot of her friends started to suddenly get AIDS, and she realized, oh yeah, I should change my role in the scene.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of it was from heroin. It wasn't AIDS just through sex. A lot of it was heroin use. And so the extra feature, I just started watching the interview with her, and it was really interesting. It was her talking very candidly about this film. I think that I'm with you. I think this is a really interesting movie. I definitely didn't love it, but then sometimes like movies, you know, it doesn't really have like narrative structure, so it's much more like impressionistic of a scene. Mm-hmm. And I was drawn to it, but it doesn't really fulfill the horror alien stuff very much. It's very, very background information.
Oh, yeah, I very loosely call it a horror movie.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah. But it's interesting.
It's just one of those, like, I want to sit down with some of the people and just be like, okay, now explain the chicken scene. Like, justify the chicken scene for me. There's just so many just weird, off-putting moments that I'm just like, why was this necessary to be in the movie? But it's there, so I feel like it needs to be part of it.
That's the fun of watching with a group, especially somebody as sharp as Josh Miller, because the whole first half, there's references to shrimp, repeated shrimp reference. You're like, why do they keep bringing up shrimp? And then that morphs into chicken.
Yes.
So we're like, oh, now we're into chicken or whatever. But more importantly, I just love so there's a character that dies after his brain or whatever explodes after having sex with the main girl. And then the boombox girl shows up and they have a box. And like, they're like, all right, we better get rid of the body. And they have like a like Christmas tree style box that just happens to be there. And it's just like, Josh is like, it's a good thing we have this human shaped box here to put this body in. It's like little convenience things like that where you're just like, oh man. But it is unlike any other experience. I can't necessarily recommend this to my audience. I'm going to be clear because certain people, like somebody had bought and watched Nightmare Sisters and hated it. And I was like, did you hear our review? And they're like, well, yeah, that's why I bought it. I was like, okay, did we not set it up properly?
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of movie you're getting into? So I don't think anybody listening to this can love and like Liquid Sky as a good movie,
analysis,
but it's an experience to watch.
Yes.
Analysis doesn't necessarily mean endorsement.
Yeah.
Bloodhook.
Well, we watch everything. We watch everything here.
Are we fans of Bloodhook?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, you are.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, go see Bloodhook. Rent Bloodhook. Buy Bloodhook.
The two-hour version. Not the two-hour version.
When I lived in New York City, one of my favorite things to do, one of my favorite things in the world was just walking around the city by myself, which I miss daily. But I used to watch movies like this that were shot in New York, and then I would literally figure out where everything was shot and just go walk around by myself and see all the locations. And so I found where their apartment was, and it's now a swanky hotel.
Of course it is.
But at the time, it was apparently a shithole. And someday when the four of us end up in New York together, I will take you on my Zoe Lund tour, where I take you to Zoe Lund's first apartment and her second apartment and the apartment she shared with Abel and everything. So, yeah.
Cool.
Zoe Lund. But
yeah, I agree with you. I think people should see this film. I think, like, it's been mentioned for years, and it's definitely a key cult movie. You know, it's key in that canon. So it's kind of thing, like, once you've watched it, I'm more interested to see it again now that I know what it is, because all these years, I guess I had something else in my head, a lot more like she's an alien having sex, and she really isn't. She's just her, and it just happens to have some connection to the alien. You don't know what it is. It's never really said. So
Josh told me he always confused it with Blue Sunshine for some reason.
Totally.
Like,
he's like,
oh, no, I've never seen this movie at all. I'm thinking of Blue Sunshine.
Love Blue Sunshine.
So anyway, what are you guys seeing?
I took a evening this week to sit down with my fiance and watch Ninja 3, The Domination.
That's right.
A film that I have never seen.
Which I just gifted to Elric.
Yeah, oh, my God.
New edition.
The one where they're possessed, right? It's like an exorcist.
This is about a ninja who is attempting to assassinate a scientist on a golf course. And over the course of 15 minutes, I'd say pretty much the entire LAPD police, the whole police force comes rolling onto this golf course, and they hunt the ninja. They shoot the ninja. They beat the ninja. They continue to shoot the ninja, but this motherfucker won't go down.
Yep.
He throws down ninja smoke bombs, and then he disappears, and the LAPD's like, where the hell did he go? He buried himself in the dirt.
That quick?
To avoid.
Opening 5 minutes. You're not missing.
Oh, no, it's longer than that. It is like 10 minutes, 12 minutes long. It is a very long time before they took this ninja down.
Oh, my gosh. He's like a tremor.
He is incredible. He is a very crafty ninja. And just nearby is a woman who works for a very beautiful woman who works for the telephone company. And while she's, working on some fiber, she comes across this ninja. He puts the whammy on her and he basically possesses her. So it's this very beautiful woman who's of two souls, one of a woman who loves aerobics and video games and doesn't drink soda. And doesn't date cops, but she does later on. And then
hairiest I've ever seen.
Jesus Christ. And then you've got the soul of the ninja who's in there, who then proceeds to use her body to exact revenge on those who killed him. Why he was after the scientists, I don't know. Why he was in America, I have no idea. What his ultimate purpose, I have no clue, but this guy from Japan flies in. He's got one eye, but he can take care of the problem. But this is a marvelous, marvelous film. Elric, if you've never seen it,
I think I'm thinking Teenage Exorcist is the one I had seen. Is this campy?
There is an exorcism.
This is canon.
I've probably seen clips on that canon documentary.
Well, it's called Ninja 3 because, even though it's not really a sequel, because they made Enter the Ninja, Revenge of the Ninja, and hence this is Ninja 3, The Domination.
Yeah. Oh my.
But it's directed by Sam Furstenberg, who also did Break Into Electric Boogaloo.
Well, that one's kind of genius.
Which he made, I want to say it was right before this,
Was it?
I think he shot it before because that's how he found Lucinda Williams, who's the lead of this movie.
Lucinda Dickey.
Dickey, that's it.
And who's also the star of Cheerleader Camp, one of my personal favorites.
Oh, yes. Is she like the puffy-haired girl?
No, she's the one that wears the mascot costume.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't want to go into spoiler on Cheerleader Camp, but
yes.
I think people have had a couple decades to catch up on Cheerleader Camp.
But this is unlike anything you'll ever see. I actually did the commentary commentary with the director on this disc.
Oh, nice.
This
did you really?
A couple of years ago, yeah.
Oh, sure.
They re-released it. It came out 5 years ago. And I had never heard or seen of it. They were like, hey, can you do this commentary? I was like, I don't know this movie. Like, watch it. And so I was marvelous. Like, I am there. I have so many questions. Yes, we get together with him, and I thank him publicly for breaking two Electric Boogaloo. And then we get down to business.
It's pretty marvelous. You get, you know, beyond the hairy cop, you get floating samurai swords.
You do?
You get a possessed Lucinda Dickey walking around in the middle of the night. You get an exorcism. I mean,
the epic usage of V8, which is
supposed drink.
To be, yes. Yes. Supposed to be sexy, but no.
How do you make the funny
thing is, she's like, I'll just tell you. So basically, after pushing this cop away, going, no, I don't date cops, and he's like, come on. And then she's like, all right, come back to my pad. She takes a shower. She walks around nude. And then the cop's like, oh, hey, you don't date cops. And she's like, she pushes him down to the couch, and then she cracks open a can of V8 and pours it on her neck and down her chest.
God. What?
And then the sex commences.
Oh.
Yes.
V8.
It's very healthy. Foreplay. Yeah.
I wonder if V8 paid for that ad. Yeah,
but this movie, I mean, it was really funny because when I came home, I was like, I want to watch Jacob's Ladder. And I was like, oh, cool. That'll kind of clear up my Shockwave's argument. We can watch that. And I said, or we can watch Ninja 3. And I explained to her what it was, and she said, all right, let's just watch the Ninja 3. So, very, very fun film that Scream Factory just put out. And you guys need to pick it up.
Yes. And if you go to YouTube, you will find the infamous V8 scene. As I'll show them.
Lucinda Dickey. And you know what? The bonus features were good. I just didn't get to the commentary. So check it out.
Cool.
Well, coming off Liquid Sky and Ninja 3 Domination, I'm going to raise this up just a little bit. I rewatched Annihilation.
Oh.
Because the first watching, it definitely left me with a couple of questions.
Did you see it in theaters?
I ended up seeing it a matinee at the Dollar Theater near, or I think it's up to $2 now. Thanks, North Hollywood. So I saw it there on like a matinee, and it definitely left me with some questions. And so I was really excited to rewatch it. And so it is now on.
Answers?
No. Okay. No, actually, I'd say on the second watch, I actually have more questions because this time I was like paying attention to things as it went along and had even more questions. But that said, it's fucking amazing and I absolutely loved it. What I did notice a lot more on the second screening was the soundtrack, which I was really aware of the Crosby, Stills, and Nash stuff the first time through. But the second time, I became more aware of that and the set design. Like, you pay attention to the flowers the first time, but then when I rewatched it, like, I was most aware of the set deck, which was just absolutely
gorgeous.
I'm
dying to do a couple spoiler episodes where we should like that in Hereditary, like, in depth, because there's certain things that I've been thinking about, especially what you're talking about, little things that at the time when I'm watching, I was like, oh, is that bad? Like a mistake, mm-hmm. and then realizing later it's the whole point of the movie that I really wanted to, but it's like, you know, can't run it on these. So.
Yeah, and I have questions that I wanted to ask that I want to discuss with somebody else where I want to be like, okay, this happened. Here's my theory of why. What do you think? I guess I just need validation so that I feel better about myself, or justification. But yeah, it definitely, I approach this movie very much in like a David Lynch style where I'm like, I don't understand exactly every single little bit of the minutia. And so I want to like argue it with somebody.
Yeah. I feel like narratively it's very straightforward.
It is.
But philosophically, what's going on is a little.
Philosophically, I think it's a little.
There's more you have to kind of dig for it.
No. I mean, like in terms of the David Lynch scale, I think it's a couple notches above David Lynch. David Lynch just goes pure Nightmare Fuel weirdness, just for the sake of weirdness sometimes, possibly. But for this, I feel like there's a purpose for.
That's what I want to believe.
I think there's a purpose for everything.
Yeah,
else,
there's like a couple of weird off-putting moments that I had seeing it on the second time I was suddenly like, oh, wait, that happened. I forgot about that happening. Why did that happen? And I want to discuss theories. So we're going to have to do a spoiler show.
And
on
I
this
still
one.
Think it has the scariest. I even would put it scarier than anything in Hereditary. I think there's one scene in that I still think is.
No, that best scene, horror is, scene that of scene is literally, yeah, so scariest thing I've seen this year.
I disagree. Really?
I'm not sure what you're talking about either.
Yeah. There's
two scares, but there's
a bear.
Yeah. Not the scariest scene for me because you know it's coming.
Well, but you don't know what it is. Yeah, it's saying it does that I thought was really useful.
For me, and I think I mentioned this, I can't remember if I talked about it a few weeks ago, is I finally watched it on Blu-ray, and the CG in this movie is so unforgivably bad for me that I didn't find that. The second it showed up, I like was angry. Because
I didn't even remember thinking about the CG on the
screen. That's the thing, because there's three or four sequences before where they just tease it in the background, and it's like really scary and interesting. Yeah. But when you see it, I was like, oh, this is... Yeah, you couldn't have a rubber head.
It wasn't
right there.
The seeing it that was scary. Yeah, it was
just
something in the
being
sound.
Too dark to really see.
Oh, the sound. The sound was
the
creepy.
Thing I'm trying not to
do, but it didn't. That was not as scary as Hereditary.
Oh, man, we need a spoiler.
Yeah. Oh my god! Yeah. No, but the idea is what terrified me. So yeah, okay. So I want to talk more about Annihilation.
Annihilation's rad.
All right.
I saw one that we're doing an animation episode for the other show, Pure Cinema, and I came across a horror animation that I had never seen. It's the 2007 black and white horror anthology from France called Fears of the Dark.
Yeah.
And it had one short that made me think of you, Becca, because it's by my favorite comic book artist, Charles Burns, and it is such a Becca story. It is like such a – it's a great little short. I like this film in general. A couple of them are a little idiosyncratic and not really scary. There's horror, you know, horror imagery. But this one is awesome. It's like literally out of black hole. It is a boy who loves to chase insects and capture insects. And at one point he finds this insect that's kind of shaped like somewhat human. And he captures it and keeps it under his bed for a while. And then eventually it somehow escapes. And then he starts having nightmares as he grows up. And he becomes a college student. And he's still obsessed by insects. And he goes out one night and he's never dated or slept with anyone. He meets a beautiful girl at a bar who seems really popular and cool. And he starts dating her. And slowly she starts like dominating him and taking over his home life, and he doesn't really know what to do. And then he sees this weird mark on her arm, kind of like the holes in Black Hole, the weird kind of ripples in the skin. And slowly you realize this is like an insect revenge movie. And it is so – I love that short. But
that
it instantly
awesome.
Made me go, oh, this is a Becca insect movie.
Okay, I'm in.
And a couple and the last short, because it's all in French. So it's French subtitled, even though some of the filmmakers involved were American. And the last short is like a guy in a haunted house. And it's great. Like, it's just – I mean, because it's black and white, it's really unusual to see an animated black and white movie too. And I thought that last short was equally good. Those two are particularly strong. And this one is available on the Sundance channel, I think. That's how I watched it. But I thought it was cool. It was a cool anthology if you haven't seen it. I had heard about it back in the day. And it was one of those things I was like, eh. I don't usually chase down animation in general. But have you guys seen this one or no?
No, I remember
Fears
when it came
with
out.
A thing around the S.
Yes, yes, yes. Dark. Oh, my God. That was
like –
I played at a festival. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. That was when I saw it.
But the one that the Charles Burns one, I think people would, everyone listening to this would probably really dig.
I need to watch it.
That was a good one.
Did you end up getting to watch Serial Experiments Lane?
What are you talking
about? I'd recommended it to
Serial Experiments
Serial
Lane?
Serial Experiment Lane. L-A-I-N. When you told me you were doing animation, I was like, you have to check that out.
No,
it's
because,
really cool.
Yeah, I had so much to watch.
Wow.
Sorry. Six years.
Oh, you'll circle back.
Yeah.
Another Blu-ray pickup for me. This is from MVD Rewind Collection. They had done Return of Swamp Thing that I talked about a couple of weeks ago. They put out the 2006 Ryan Schifrin movie, Abominable.
Yep.
I've never seen this.
I remember, Ryan, we were
saw
in,
it
the,
so
in
much.
The thick of the web game when this came out. And it was a lot of fun at the time. It was, Ryan is the son of Layla Schifrin, the legendary composer. So Layla did the music for this. And it's just a really fun Bigfoot movie. It's got everybody from Jeffrey Combs to Matt McCoy to Lance Hendrickson to Tiffany Shepis has a bit part in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's just basically a Rear Window with a Bigfoot. And the monster looks pretty cool. What's fascinating about this Blu-ray they did is they really went above and beyond. Basically, they shot it on film, but they never transferred the footage in high def. They had just done a DVD transfer, which was good enough for DVD at that point. So apparently they went back to the original materials and completely re-edited it shot for shot in high def. And that includes redoing and finishing the effects because they lost all the effects files for like little things like the Bigfoot's eyes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so basically they have restructured this movie from top to bottom, recut it, redone all the effects and everything.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so it's a little bit slightly more polished than what we remember on the DVD, although it includes that DVD version as well, if, you know, if you're a completist. And so, yeah, so I rewatched it again. And basically, Matt McCoy is of Police Academy 5 fame. Is
that Mission to Moscow?
Wait, what was he in? No, that's Citizens on Patrol. No, wait, that's 3.
Miami. The
6
Miami
is Mission to Moscow. Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, what was 7? He in the Miami 7? One?
Jesus.
He's the lead guy that replaced Steve Guttenberg. Obviously, should have been Steve Guttenberg because he has that swagger, or he's supposed to be Steve Guttenberg. But anyway, he's in that. He's in a wheelchair after a terrible accident.
Wasn't
he goes back to this
Deep
town.
Star 6?
Yeah, he might have been. Yeah,
I think
probably,
he is. Becca coming in Deep Star 6 facts.
But anyway, he comes back home to a cabin, which he hasn't been to since this, you know, accident that him and his wife had, and he's in a wheelchair, and across the way is obviously a cabin full of young girls that are partying, this and that, and basically, you know, they initially just think he's like a kind of creepy, a voyeur, just like watching them, but he sees something in the woods, and there's a giant Bigfoot that is running around kind of between them, but really they have small scenes, but Jeffrey Combs like steals this movie. Him and Lance Egerton have a great sequence around a fireplace where they're talking about the Darwin Awards. And so for that alone, just like to get to see Lance and Jeffrey Combs, who I don't think had done a movie before this together and might not have since.
Yeah.
But this is the one movie that you get to see those two together. So that's really fun. And Ryan included two of his short films on here too. So I always love when filmmakers do that, when they include a lot of their early work, so you can kind of see how they've grown and gotten to this point. So really good disc, Abominable from MVD Rewind Collection.
Nice.
I'm presuming I'm the only one at this table who saw Rampage in theaters, The Rock.
Yes.
Giant monster movie.
Oh, yeah, I did not see it.
Yes, okay, but I do want to see it.
Okay, so I was at I was in another part of the country for the last week, and there was one night where I had absolutely nothing to do, and I looked across the street, and playing at the theater was still Black Panther and Rampage. Good on Black Panther for still being in theaters, now obviously being on home video across all platforms, and good on Rampage as well. I went across the street thinking I was going to be the only one seeing Rampage, but it was a semi-packed house.
Wow.
Which was insane. I'll make this brief because there's something larger I would love to talk about. But it is, I mean, did I think they would make a Rampage game after being such a... I was a disciple of the arcade game. I loved playing it, but there's obviously no story. This film is a Saturday morning cartoon brought to life.
Oh, that's awesome.
Very lampoonish characters. The Rock is obviously probably the most grounded character of the group. But they're the villains. There are villains, very distinct villains, mustache twirly baddies who are responsible for these giant monsters coming to life. But man, the effects were really good. I'll say that. I had a really good time. Once the monsters all descended on Chicago for a reason, it was just, I found myself chuckling when, because you got George, who is the big ape that that's friends of the Rock, and who isn't friends of the Rock. And all the monsters are kind of going out of their mind for a very good reason because of the villains. And they're all like kind of descending on this one particular building. And there was just one shot that had the gorilla climbing up the building, the giant alligator thing climbing up the building and doing his kind of like slow movement.
Is he?
And then and then the wolf that has wings like a flying squirrel, like all climbing up the building. And I just went, yeah, I'm into this. Because the alligator climbs up the building and then he decides to go through it as opposed to keep climbing. It's just something really, I think it was baked into my DNA. I just love giant monsters. I love giant monsters stomping around shit. And if you throw the Rock in, even better.
You know, so, I love that Rock.
I do love the Rock.
I'll watch anything with that.
He's a stand-up guy. I mean, like
he's great in Moana too.
Sure he is.
I just saw the new Jumanji. Great.
Yeah. Oh, Jumanji's great.
And what's the new Die Hard movie he's in?
It looks like Skyscraper. Yeah, I mean,
Skyscraper.
Yeah. That's it's him.
Skyscraper.
But it's the Rock. Yeah. But he's got an artificial leg.
I.
I'm in.
I know.
He's what?
I know.
He's got like a bum leg.
No, he's got like a bum leg. And I was like, okay, what is that? What is it? It seems like this is the year where people are missing appendages just to like get me on their side.
Yeah.
And it's like, no. I mean, yes, obviously. But when I saw the Rock trailer with him, I was like, ooh, Neve Campbell, high scream. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, the Rock is missing a leg. Oh, I got to see how he gets out of this. And then the next day I saw the trailer for Dumbo.
Oh, boy.
And it was, Colin Farrell.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, I'm gonna start crying because they're singing the song and there's a little baby Dumbo. And then you see Colin Farrell and he's got one arm. And I was like, no, Colin Farrell, why do you have one arm? But anyways, Rampage was enjoyable.
I lost so many hours to that game when I was
a
kid.
So did I.
I mean, like the standing arcade game, and then when it came to NES. I mean, but you could do moves on the standing arcade game that you couldn't do on NES.
Yeah.
So, like the down punch when you'd like move really quick down the building.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that on the NES.
That one of them doesn't turn into a human.
Well, I think that should be the sequel.
And scamper off naked while holding their garage.
I think that should be the sequel. I think the Rock should turn into a giant fucking monster.
Yes.
And then
then
what you have is in the trailer, you've got the giant monster stumbling through the building because he's a monster and he doesn't know how to use his monster body. And then the next scene is all of these people shocked on the street, and then you've got a naked Rock going, oh, pardon me, excuse me, and then like turning away because he transformed. Elric's giving me a look of complete confusion.
Did you never play the game?
Is this the trailer where that starts like Gorillas in the Mist? Like it seems like it's about him and this big group.
Yes.
That's the trailer.
Okay, weird. Yeah.
I keep thinking that was like a small movie, and then I forget that it turns into this giant
crazy. Oh, it's huge.
Cluster.
It's huge.
Okay.
But in the same,
I don't think I do remember the game, though.
Yeah. In the same vein of video games, I just want to do a little shout out to something that has consumed my life. Goosebumps Horror Town. If you guys haven't played this mobile app, get into it. It's a lot of fun. Becca caught me playing it because I had to unleash my monsters. But basically what you do is you have a blank canvas, a town, that you can build streets, build buildings.
So it is Sims. I literally said, Ryan, are you playing Sims?
I never played Sims,
right?
So when people say, is it Sims? I'm like, yeah, sure. And then what you have is you build buildings, and then these little mini spooky stories unfold, and you get all the characters. And then every once in a while, once you've unlocked certain buildings, you can unleash the monsters on the town. And you've just got, there's a particular amount of glee I have from seeing all these civilians running and then these monsters chasing them, and then you collect the scary faces, and then you add that to your collection of scary faces and you get more things. But the programmers have identified that I am a power user, so within 2 days of me playing, because I've been on set and I've just been kind of like in my off hours at the hotel, I've just been playing, they sent me a private email and they're like, hey, just a heads up, we'd love your input. And I was like, how do you guys know that?
They're tracking your gameplay.
But anyways, I got CR on it now. But it's a really fun game. And if you're a fan of the Goosebumps property, a lot of familiar characters pop in, a lot of villains and stuff like that. So anyways, Goosebumps Horror Town.
Well, before we move on, I have to give a shout to Rampage for amazing merchandising toys. I have not even seen the movie yet. If you go into Walmart right now, they have a whole like
what
section of Rampage toys. And the coolest thing, and we are now the proud owner of one of them, they have Stretch Armstrong-ish dolls for all of the three main characters, Ralph, Izzy, and I can't remember the name of the monkey.
Ralph?
George.
And so we got Ralph and Izzy, but they're like full Stretch Armstrong, like late 70s Stretch Armstrong. But they have some amazing toys for these.
Lizzie,
which,
nice.
Marnie had to have, so we now have several of those.
I want to mention really quickly, I know Elric talked about it, I think it was last week, but I watched Scalpel, the Arrow Blu-ray, after you mentioned it, which is very much a very sleazy version of Eyes Without a Face, if you do say so. I did try to watch the color, the version that the DP did, and I couldn't.
Is it just too extreme?
It's
because I didn't watch. I watched the other one, and then
it's too dark.
Okay,
it's too dark and a little too weird. You can actually switch while you're watching, back and forth. So I did it for a little while, and I was like, no, the Arrow was right to correct it.
Yeah.
You know the way it is. But listen to Elric's review of it. But it is a But this is the director of Blood Rage?
Yeah, it's a very different movie, still bonkers.
I was kind of blown away by that.
It feels just like a drama to me. Like, there wasn't a lot of horror in it. It's called Scalpel.
It's got Southern Gothic sleaziness, though, which I love. That's
a lot.
I love about
and
it.
The girl playing both characters, And then him having a romantic relationship
that's
with
her. That's
the
part that I
the
was
like. The one that
like,
looks like his daughter.
Yeah, yes. That's when it got tense
the good
for
stuff.
Me.
But then there's fun twists that happen after that. So anyway, check out Scalpel from Arrow. Yeah.
I like it.
Another thing I wanted to mention that I think all of us watch it. This is something, Elric, you brought up, I think, on Killer POV years ago.
Oh, boy.
And it is The Staircase, which has now made it onto Netflix.
Yeah, it's been my favorite documentary series for like
decades.
I had not seen this until you guys were talking about it at Etheria, and then I was like, I have to see this, and I'm on the fourth episode now.
Oh. It's great. So basically, you had told it, it's basically about the death of this woman named Kathleen, and in a mysterious circumstances, falling down the staircase, a whole lot of blood, a lot of weird marks that don't make sense. And her husband, Michael Peterson, was the one that was accused of murder.
Because he was the only one there at the time.
He was the only one there that discovered the body, etc. And so the documentary was from these French filmmakers who basically followed the case. But where it gets interesting, people are like comparing it to Making a Murderer, and I'm like, yeah, but this was 10 years before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this was a documentary that was 8 episodes, which is, I think, the version you saw. When you told us about it.
Yeah, when I first knew about it. Yeah.
Then they did a follow-up maybe 2-3 years ago.
Pretty recently, yeah.
Yeah, 2 episodes.
Yeah, just to kind of show where the court case had gone.
Yes, and now Netflix has created 3 brand new episodes.
Which I haven't watched
those yet. So there's 13 in total, and they're all on Netflix now. And again, if you're into those true crime kind of deals, the case does keep getting more mysterious and weird. And although I missed the owl thing, which you said
it definitely is in the early stuff. Just
that
as
was
a theory,
because I'm on episode 4 or 5 now, and they've definitely thrown out the owl theory. in which case, I was suddenly like researching, like we have screech owls, and then I was like, could one come in a window, knock somebody down, and then somehow escape back through the window without leaving any trace? Like the crazy ninja owl.
Well, there was trace, wasn't there? That's the whole point.
Some claw hair, marks.
Whatever.
Claw
anyway,
marks. But
that's the most outrageous of all the theories.
But if you want to, watching Mistrial of Justice, that kind of thing, what is our justice system? Like, this isn't a spoiler because whether he's innocent or guilty, this has been 10 years since I've seen, I still don't know how exactly I feel about it. But in terms of just watching how the judicial system works against you in this country, and especially if you like people like us, you're into horror, suddenly you have less of a chance in that court case. Like, watching the information add up against this guy is pretty brutal, and really I think it's just fantastically put together.
And that's something interesting that the documentary does, is when you watch Making of a Murderer, it's clearly its main mission is to prove that this guy is likely innocent. And when you were watching some of the other ones on Netflix, like, it's clear from the get-go that they have kind of a slant. This one, at least, and this is just I'm only on episode 4 or 5, does not seem to have one.
The director definitely does. I don't know about the new episodes, but he's said in many interviews, like, the only reason it seems maybe slanted towards Michael is because that's the person he's following most, but he doesn't have an agenda. I've seen interviews with the director where he says, I still don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
all these years later, he doesn't know 100%.
You should definitely see the last 3 that just got added to Netflix, because it's interesting. I mean, if you obviously you can Google after you watch kind of stuff that happened, but the editor on the project all these years is apparently with him now.
I mean, but they also fell in love after. Like,
wait,
it's not
with
like the
director or with Michael?
With Michael Peterson,
the editor. She's a French
the character of who they're following.
Okay.
But that doesn't affect the originals.
No, it does. No, it doesn't.
They hadn't.
No.
They hadn't met until after. They fell in love in this process later, you know. And I think
a bit weird.
Happens, you know. I don't know.
Anything else?
Yeah, I'll throw out a couple more. So I had posted up on Twitter a couple of days ago that I love the movie The Bay, and that I wish people that there was another one like that. And this goes back to
who made that?
Blumhouse made that. That's the Blumhouse film.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Before my time.
But I absolutely love that. It definitely, and I don't like found footage films usually.
This is the second week in a row you've talked about.
I know,
one.
Right? Right?
So if it's next week, we will have a trifecta.
So, but I love the bug-based stuff. And there are not a lot of bug-based horror movies. They just don't get that much action for a number of reasons, I feel. But I had posted up that, you know, I wish that there was some others. And people on Twitter immediately referred me to 2 of them, one of which I discovered I had seen before. So the first one I watched was 2006's Larva.
Ugh, I already don't want to watch it.
Date night with Becca.
No, this one had William Forsythe in it, who was playing this like angry, brooding cowboy who was basically, he was gnawing on the scenery the whole time. He had really like long flowing hair that he would flip when he got angry. The whole concept is that there's this evil meat packing or evil meat company, and they're like putting all these chemicals into the cows, and it's causing, this is like a very common plot line with insect horror. So it's causing these parasites to grow at an alarming rate, and then oops, now they're eating people whenever they eat the beef, and then it goes crazy and they grow to huge proportions. This movie was definitely like Sci-Fi Channel grade. I will say like I had fun watching it because William Forsythe kept flipping his hair around and chewing on toothpicks. That said, I would not call this a good movie by any means. Do you got a parasite in your ear?
Larva.
She's talking about Marvin. Ryan Richards.
Something was crawling around.
Sure it was.
Who was using these headphones?
And then the second one that I saw is from 2009. And this one, as soon as I started watching it, Ryan, see what
I
do?
What did you do?
What did I do? I totally planted like a
Star Trek II Rathacon larva.
I think you might notice that one wandering around. Those fuckers were big. So this is from 2009. This was a Lionsgate film called Thaw. And this one had Val Kilmer in it, who was also gnawing on the scenery, but he was not in the movie very much. You could tell that like they could only afford him for a day. So they have like a day of Kilmer and then he's done. And this one had a much smarter plot where it's set in the Arctic Circle. They are there investigating global warming and they discover that a woolly mammoth has actually been kind of defrosted and unearthed from the ice. And then they discover that there are these prehistoric parasites on the woolly mammoth that breed uncontrollably. There's never a point where they grow to like Sci-Fi Channel levels. It's always just crowds. It does feel a lot like an X-Files episode, but like an X-Files episode that I would really like. So I enjoyed it in that regard. Fun effects. They did, my favorite moment in the entire thing though is when one of the grad students approaches and he has his notebook and it says like vertebrates on the front of his notebook and he has misspelled vertebrates. So that was fun. But this one is better of the two. And if you are into bug horrors, I recommend checking out Thaw. The effects were pretty good. But then again, if you're really into bug horrors, just, you know, start with The Bay. So,
The Bay.
Yeah. Right.
I had a good quick question for Ryan. Or is there a follow-up?
It's in my ear.
Is there another insect car?
Well, kind of, actually. Not really. I rewatched Pitch Black.
Oh.
It's on HBO Go right now. And so I watched it last night at like 10:30. I was like, I'll just watch Pitch Black.
All right, Diesel or Rock, you guys?
Diesel.
Let's make the choice. Diesel or Rock? Are you a Vin?
Rock.
Oh, see, I like
you can only choose one.
Personality alone.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Vin, he's kind of a smartass, but at the same time, he's kind of like a gross smartass.
Would you watch Larva with him?
No. I don't think I would watch Larva with anybody.
Would you watch
Vin Diesel with
Vin Diesel?
If he asked. Potentially.
Go to first base with the movie?
Would you go to first base with The Rock, Ryan?
This is going into weird territory.
It's getting weird, dude.
A crazy hairpiece in that one Sidney Lumet film where the look. And you're like, what the hell is he doing? It's like, so wrong.
He shaves his head with diesel oil in this one, or it's some type of like axle grease. It's fun. So I forgot how much I love this movie. Like, I knew I'd love this one. I did not enjoy Chronicles of Riddick because Chronicles of Riddick was like where they doubled down on the Vin Diesel quality.
Yeah. It got too big. It became an intergalactic, like.
Well, Pitch Black
80s.
Was very Aliens to me. That's what I haven't seen it in years, but I remember it being almost like a low budget Aliens.
Yeah. And that's what I had completely forgot was how low budget. And I mean, when I looked it up, it actually wasn't. It was $23 million, which I guess is small for a studio pick. Yeah. That's still pretty small.
But it felt big. It felt big.
It felt huge. But then when you watch it, I realized last night the majority, there's occasional times when they're in like metal structures, but I would easily say 60% of the movie is outside. In sand with maybe some bones behind them. And it's just an 8-person cast. Like, I think it starts with 12, and then by the time that the movie gets going, there's only 8 of them left. And then, so what they're paying for, I'm sure, was digital effects. Plus, Vin Diesel was not, like, this was definitely his breakout movie.
Yeah.
So it was not like a star-packed thing.
Wait, is that the same director as Triple X?
It's David Toei.
It's not the Rob, whatever.
I just really enjoyed
it. That's what I liked about Riddick is that, you know, Toei took it a little too far into the let's build a franchise for the Chronicles of Riddick. And then with Riddick, he pared it back and made it more, again, a creature feature action movie.
But Riddick bothered me. Well, it didn't bother me. It just, this one... I mean, like, Vin Diesel's character is a total asshole,
yeah,
but not to the point that he's unbearable. Right, right. I found him borderline unbearable in Riddick,
yeah,
where I was just like, you're just an awful person. Yeah.
Yeah. What's up with David Tui's IMDb pick, man? Look at that thing. He's gone fishing.
And then I will also say, just a
where
quick
is
plug.
He?
He's gone fishing.
He is gone fishing. Maybe that was while filming Below.
Oh, could have been.
I do like Below.
I love Below.
I think he's just in Bloodhook mode, quite frankly.
Bloodhook mode. And so, last plug, just because it's one that never got a lot of love and it should have received a lot more, Tale of Tales, which was on my top 10 list from 2 years ago, is now on Netflix. So watch
I've been meaning to watch that,
there.
Actually. Yeah. Yeah.
It did not get a lot of love. And it's quite possibly one of the most beautiful films
it looks
I've
great.
Seen
the only bad thing
years.
Is it's really long. That's
it is.
Yeah. But that's because it's an anthology, right?
It's good, yeah. But the anthologies, they all wind together. So it's like you never realize when one story drifts into another because you're following the characters through.
The quick question for Ryan was just to clarify, because you weren't here last week for the Heredity conversation, and we know you liked it because we heard you talk way back, but I wanted to have you seen it again since
I've seen
that
it
first
twice.
View? So you have seen it since the first viewing? Yeah. What's the weigh in just so we
can really Shockwaves approved.
Yeah, so we get that clear.
Approved. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think
well, what was it like on second viewing? Because I want to see it again.
Well, I was seeing it with CR, and I was seeing it with people who have never seen it before. So she turned to me and she was like, eh. And I was like, what? And she was like, no, there's some really silly stuff at the very end. And I was like, oh, God, I was really into that.
Yeah.
So it's one of those divisive movies. And you know what? I still liked going on that journey. I mean,
I think it needs to have a little bit of the silly stuff at the end. Otherwise, I think we would all die.
Oh,
because it's so heavy in the middle. No, I think we need
so
something a little
heavy
crazy.
I think that, you know, I do think it's got a little bit of a pacing issue in that middle section that you can easily kind of trim back.
And I think make it a scary movie. If you trimmed a little bit in the middle and gave less answers,
no,
I think
I'm,
it'd be scary.
I'm okay with it. I mean, like, I feel like the film is pretty clear cut the first time around.
Yeah.
I understood what was going on. The second time around, it was about watching some of the details
of the revelations
and all the stuff that's in there. But on the second go around, it also showcased some of its plotting flaws where you're like, wait a second, you are revisiting a thing that you went to the first time around and now you're... That's pretty apparent, some information.
But I also wonder how much is lost. You know, I mean, not that I want to see a three-hour version by any – I do not. But,
no, I don't.
But clearly the guy said, you know, his first cut was 3 hours. That's not great. His first cut, but the actual cut he originally could have shown. And so that means there's a lot of family stuff on the floor. So
for
I wonder what,
sure, but
what
I
was
think,
essential, what wasn't.
You know what? But I think he got the best family stuff out of it.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think
there's
so.
Nothing
yeah, there's
more
some great
than
stuff
I needed to see at all.
Yeah.
So
I still – yeah, I think it's a great film, but I am curious to see it again. See how it changes a little bit. But,
yeah.
But it is Shockwaves approved then.
It is Shockwaves approved.
Predator, yeah.
Yeah.
And not necessarily Mole approved. Mole audience is not necessarily
no,
loving
Mole. Not going to like it.
But, you know, what can you do?
I just want to give a shout out to Stephen King. Yo,
oh,
Stephen King.
What's up, King?
You know, Stephen King.
He needs it. He listens.
Yeah, exactly.
Huge
he's
fan.
He's a huge fan.
Shocker all the way.
I'm currently reading his latest book, The Outsider. This is the first King book I've read since Under the Dome.
Thick. Will he ever slow down? That's a lot of book.
I mean, I skipped over the Mercedes trilogy.
So many pages.
Yeah, but this is... I usually tend to gravitate back to him when he goes into these big, epic, meaty novels.
Yeah.
So this is a wonderful book so far. Given that he doesn't
what kind
like,
of horror?
I hope
what
he
kind of thing is it? Like what kind of vibe?
It's a procedural for the first half. So basically, you've got a story of a little boy who is found murdered viciously, like sodomized, throat torn out, all sorts of vile stuff had happened to him, and the local police. This is set in It's set in Michigan. And it is, and all the local police and their investigation, they have every shred of evidence that points to it's the Little League coach. Every bit of, they have eyewitness reports, they've got DNA, they've got all the stuff. And then they pick him up in a very dramatic fashion. And he's like, I wasn't even in town. And they look to find out where he was, and all evidence points to he wasn't even in town.
Yeah, so rock solid alibi, right?
Rock solid alibi.
But who else could it be?
But what could it be? Yeah. And I'm getting now into the many answers. But man,
the cover of the book looks like a real horror thing with
monstrous. It's starting to lean there. Okay. Yeah, yeah. But I think this is definitely King in his prime and very good book. I'm a big fan of Under the Dome. I felt Under the Dome kind of dropped the ball in the last last third. But you know, I especially like King when he's doing stories like this and not doing these kind of like three-parter Mr. Mercedes types things. I just don't engage in that. So welcome back. Great stuff. Give it a read.
Wow.
Nice.
And if you want a great comic thing for summer, I've been reading, I think I already mentioned that Alan Moore's run on Swamp Thing. I'm borrowing all the graphic novels of that, and it's just, I'm absolutely head over heels in love with this story now. It's just so good. Like that world, really cool. I can't remember, is it called Return of the Swamp Thing? I can't recall. It has a different name than just Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
But it's great.
I think there's collections of just the Alan Moore Swamp Thing.
Yeah, that's all I'm starting on. So I'm like a couple books in. Really good stuff.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get our guest. Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, the Ash vs. Evil Dead collection featuring incredible t-shirts and a sliding chainsaw enamel pin. They just released a brand new line of House of a Thousand Corpses trading cards. The first collection of Cabin in the Woods t-shirts and pins are now available. The collection has 3 awesome Cabin in the Woods t-shirts and 5 enamel pins, which are the various monsters from the film. And on the 4th of July, Fright Rags will be releasing a whole new Jaws collection. And if you look back at the Shockwave team's picks at Texas Frightmare, you will see the entire Shockwaves crew is wearing Fright Rags. They keep us clothed. They keep us warm. We love them. So head to FrightRags.com now. That's Fright-Rags.com. And you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. So head to www.Fright-Rags.com now.
The Shockwaves crew is also super excited to announce that we are headed to Mad Monster Party in Phoenix this July. This amazing convention runs from July 13th through 15th at the Weekapah Resort just outside of Phoenix in Scottsdale, Arizona. Mad Monster has some amazing guests lined up like Robert Englund, Kane Hodder, Lance Henriksen, and plus a ton of guests from the entire Elm Street franchise. And the Shockwaves team will be there doing a live show. Check out madmonster.com for more info, and we can't wait to see you in Arizona. And while you're there, touch Elric's face. Just touch it.
Whoop, whoop. I just want to do a little shout out to a celebration at Sunnyside Cemetery hosted by Festival Obscura. I'll be there Saturday, June 30th. This is in Long Beach, California, 1095 East Willow Street. Our friends at Phantom Carriage have put this on. It's going to be a fun event with vendors, music, movies, all sorts of good stuff. So check it out. But don't touch my face. All right. We have a very special guest in the house. If you guys have noticed, when I get excited, it's because we have makeup effects guys on the air. We have Tony Gardner. And who else? Who else?
Well,
we
Steve
have?
Johnson is here.
Steve Johnson, but I wasn't here. That. But I sat there listening and got giddy about
in
it.
Awe.
So, in awe. Yeah. So that was fun. But very happy to say that we have Mr. Chris Nelson in the house, who I just worked with on Halloween.
Hey.
That's right.
I heard of that.
What
is that movie?
A little Halloween movie? That's kind of cool. To be clear, Christopher Alan Nelson, if you'd like to check the IMDb's. That's his full name on there.
Yes, yes, yes. Chris, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. And again, you can just call me Nelson.
Nelson.
I was a little worried because before you came on, I looked up the other guy. There's another Chris Nelson, and I think he did the effects on Shazam with Shaq, and I wasn't sure how to tackle that with you. So I'm kind of relieved that we don't have to go down
that road.
A
whole different set
and
of
all
questions
a different episode
for you. Now
that's a credit I wish I had.
Shazam, all right.
Chris, it's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
It was cool to see you in action, on set, doing some cool stuff.
Thank you.
And it must be an exciting time for you because now that the mask has been revealed, now you're getting nonstop feedback, and I haven't seen anything negative, which is kind of a surprise.
Can we ask about the mask? Are we allowed to? Like how the creation process happened? No, I didn't.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I think it's fine because you've done the interview. The interviews have gone out from set.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the embargo was lifted, so I'm sure it's okay.
Can I just report to you, Ryan? Because we were at Monsterpalooza a few months ago, and I did a panel right after your panel with Tony Timpone.
Oh, right, yeah.
And Tony was, I mean, he was doing the business trying to get any Halloween stuff out of him, and Chris was not having any of it.
He was up. He was very
straightforward and to the point. Sure. And I think you guys are going to love the movie and blah, blah, blah. Didn't get any details out of this guy.
Wow. Nice.
Bravo. Right, bravo. Yeah. That's good. Well, yeah, I'm sure. I mean, it's okay. It's safe to talk about it because, I mean, like I said, you conducted interviews on set that are now out there into the world. So, Becca, what did you have?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to know what your process was because there's a lot riding on it. And you've also got this huge legacy of what the mask looks like and how it changes for each film and each incarnation. And so how did you approach it?
Well, first and foremost, I approach it like a fan and just a lover of Halloween who's super passionate for the original film. That was the only way I felt you could approach it. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I would not be here without Mr. Ryan Turek here. I wouldn't have been working on the movie had we not talked. And I was like, I have to do Halloween. You have to let me do Halloween. So it's like Halloween is such a huge influence on me and my entire life and career and cinema and everything like that. Of course, I love everything other than genre movies. But that movie really changed my life when I was 10 years old, saw it in the theater. And it changed everything. And but as far as approaching the mask goes, I approach it as a fan and someone who, not to take anything away from all the other people that made the masks and things for the sequels and stuff, but what I wanted to see, you know, what was missing for me for a Halloween film. And I knew that everybody involved in this movie was going to be really passionate and really loved Halloween. So there was a lot of pressure. But like most things that I do, or anything that I've accomplished in my life, I kind of put blinders on and I don't think of the repercussions and I just do the best, you know, I just head for the goal, you know. So really studied the original mask, got copies of, you know, the Shatner mask and pulls from the original and thousands of photos and sculptures and really studied them, although I've been studying that mask for 40 years. And got really – and my crew – that helped me build everything. They're also experts in the mask, and we really painstakingly made sure that mask was going to give the fans what they wanted. And I wasn't going to let it go out the door until it was exactly what it needed to be. It just wasn't going to happen. So I really wanted it to change, really wanted it to look different in every single angle because the original mask looks different every angle that you look at it. So that was a huge goal of mine, which is not easy. And also then to take into the context of the film and when it takes place was another challenge because, you know, Rob Zombie and Wayne Toth did a fine job with their mask aged and everything like that. But, you know, we obviously didn't want to go down that road. We wanted to do something new and different but still maintain the form. You know, there was talk about drastically kind of changing it at one point. And I felt that if you did that, then the fans are going to be really disappointed. It has to be that form. I don't care how weathered you make it or what you do, but it's got to have that classic Kirk form. Yeah. It's got to have that shape. And so really worked hard to make sure that happened.
Yeah. I mean, like, the first time we saw it, we were just giddy, and I'm using the word giddy a lot because it's just very exciting, this episode. But no, the first time we saw it, we just chuckled.
Oh, God.
Jesus Christ.
Just even in sculpture form, I started getting all excited when it was in clay form. I was like, oh, my God, there it is. And I can't wait till it's in latex. Then when it was latex, it's even more exciting. Then you put hair on it. So every step of the way was just super exciting, almost bringing me to tears. And then I remember the day that I brought it on set for the first time when I got to South Carolina and it was time to do the show and tell. We were down doing rehearsal for one of the scenes and took it in the house and pulled it out of the bag. And it was just – it was that moment. Put it on Jim, I think it was. And we were just like and it was like everything.
And keep in mind, too, Chris treats the mask like those dudes that you see at the Academy Awards with the handcuffs and the Oscar winners. Yeah. And, you know, he comes in with this like black duffel bag, and then he makes sure he does like a sweep with his eyes across all the street, like the sidewalks and everything, because we were outdoors when we were shooting it. And then he did a sweep, and he was like, okay, there's no one around. We'll take,
you take it out.
Yeah, and he took it out, but it was great.
It was pretty sad.
Not like, sad at all.
And the crew kept asking me, hey, you sleep with that thing? What's it? I got made fun of so much.
I'm amazed it didn't leak out early, to be honest. Yeah. You guys were really careful.
We worked
that.
Really hard.
It was a lot of headaches. Yeah. That was it was a headache to keep you know, keep it under wraps. We had it was funny because I think it was the second day that we actually used a mask. Second or third day. Uh-huh. And then this TV, because we were shooting outdoors, this TV crew came.
Oh,
and they just set up across the street. Now, I used to work for a local broadcast news company. And the rule is you can't be near the production. But if you're across the street, that's somebody else's property. And you can do whatever you want and shoot whatever you want. So we had to kindly go over there and talk to them and explain to them what we were doing. And please don't shoot anything. And they were really cool about it. But yeah. But the funny thing is once it was out in the public, like, I mean, like, on that day, once Jim was wearing the mask, people were just driving by. No one gave a shit. People were just, one guy went by on a bike and was like, yo, Mike!
Yeah.
Yo, Mikey!
It is funny, the scrutiny. I was saying this before. You weren't here last week, but we talked about the Halloween trailer. I've never met a more passionate fan base than the Halloween franchise.
It's unbelievable.
It's ridiculous.
I mean,
detail.
I knew they were passionate, but now since the images have come out and the trailer, it's
crazy.
God bless them.
Yeah. They're picking into what's great, too, is they're picking up on all the little details. You know, we won't go into spoilers here, but the little details that they're picking out on Instagram where someone sent me an Instagram image of Lori stabbing Michael in the neck from the 78 film. And then it's a close up screen grab of our mask with the hole.
With that little pin
drop. And they were like, it was a big circle with an arrow pointing to it. look at this. I was like, that's great. But listen, I mean, like, I've always been a fan of yours, and your career was one I always followed. It's funny because there was a time when people talked about makeup effects guys and they were like, which one's Chris? And I was like, oh, he was he was the groom in Kill Bill. Or he was you were in Planet Terror too, weren't you? Did you have a little bit in Planet Terror?
No.
But you know who he was, Ryan. He was the killer in The Tripper.
Oh, the killer in The Tripper. And Land of the Dead.
Land of the Dead
is one I watched flying back out to South Carolina. I was like, oh, there's Chris.
Yeah,
but
twice I'm in Land of the Dead.
Yeah.
As a regular person. And then I play the father zombie, and I get my head machine gunned off, and the what's the guy's name, the main zombie, Big Daddy, his name. He's holding my head as I'm looking around. He throws it on the ground.
I didn't know that was that. That's great.
Yeah,
but I mean, obviously, I mean, like the you know, just kind of describing your most recent career. It's obviously it goes back. Your love for the genre goes deep, and I'm looking, you know, kind of looking at your IMDb, does it really extend? Was there an experience before Batman Returns, which I see is like the, or was there?
I think, you know, when it gets that far back for me, it gets a little fuzzy of the timeline. Batman Returns was one of the first things that I did. One of the major first things that I got to work on. I think around that time, I was also working for like Optic Nerves. I was working on a lot of like, stuff that's not on my IMDb, I don't think.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff like from Full Moon.
Yeah.
You know, those Charlie Band movies. Yeah. Like I worked on Mandroid and Doll Man versus Demonic Toys.
Nice.
You know, a lot of that stuff. A lot of going in and doing a gag or two or doing a makeup or two and getting out of there. So I think professionally making money, like, oh my God, I'm making money.
Making some good money.
Did you just learn?
It was late 80s, 90, I think.
Interesting.
Did you just learn on the job, like apprenticeships, or did you actually like have any formal training that went into it?
I didn't have any training. I mean, I taught myself throughout most of my childhood, you know, as a little tiny kid when Fangoria came out, the very first issue I had it, and was already messing around with makeup because I just loved Lon Chaney. That was my guy, and that hence the interest in acting as well, you know. But and I just used to just see every horror movie I could, and you know, at that time they weren't. I could walk into a theater, you know, a rated R movie in the middle of nowhere outside of Pittsburgh. They weren't really checking, you know. So I got to see a lot of cool stuff in the theater, but. No, I didn't. I just taught myself. Tom Savini had a book out called Grand Illusions, which was, you know, an awesome thing. There were a lot of old makeup books and theatrical makeup books and stuff that I loved so much, and just started messing around with it. And practiced, and moved to Los Angeles and rented a, you know, bacon foam latex out of my oven in the some shitty apartment and smelling up the joint and getting Roma clay dug into the carpet and losing my deposit. And it was all very messy, and but, you know, just trying and taking photos of everything. And it was just a really a lot of hard work, a lot of networking. I really beat down the doors and really just bugged everybody to death until somebody gave me a job.
And who was that first person?
That first person was Tom Berman.
Oh, well.
Tom Berman and Barry Berman were the first people to hire me formally, and it was a Budweiser commercial. There used to be a mascot for Budweiser called Budman. I don't know if you guys remember.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, I don't remember. Yeah.
They parodied him on The Simpsons. Like I remember Duff Man. Simpsons. Yeah. Duffman, that was it.
Yeah. I worked on Budman was one of my first major jobs for Tom Berman, Yeah, and just it went from there. I just really just hustled. And there were times where they were like, hey, do you know how to do this? And I'd be like, sure. But I'd never done it really professionally. So, you know, I really hope this works. And then it worked. So yeah. I did learn a lot on the job. I learned from a lot of really great artists in those shops and things like that. And around that time, there weren't a whole lot of people that driven that wanted to do it, you know. So I just worked really hard. It certainly wasn't I didn't get to where I am the easy way, that's for sure, you know. But I had a lot of cool people that gave me shots, and I tried to live up to them, you know. So
on Batman Returns, I mean, obviously, I'm imagining this is your kind of like, this is the first big giant thing.
Oh, dude.
I mean, take me on the first day. Like, because a lot of that was like stage work, too. They shot
it. Was.
Yeah, Gotham was mostly on stage.
I'll never forget that. That is such a pivotal moment in my career because I worked on Batman Returns with two different companies. I worked puppeteering penguins for Stan Winston's company. He made all those penguins.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I was puppeteering a lot of
missiles
those.
Missiles and stuff.
And then I worked for Optic Nerve. John Bullich and Everett Burrell made these little mechanical bats that plugged in, you know, when a couple people like the Penguin and I think this woman is on top of a rooftop and these bats fly out and she, you know, something like that. So we made all those mechanical bats and stuff. So I'll never forget it. That was on the Universal lot, the biggest stage that Universal has. They built Gotham, and I'll never forget. Universal Studios to me was this like magical place. You know, ever since I was a kid, I was flying out to Los Angeles every summer and visiting my mother because my mother lived out here, and I would always make her take me to Universal every summer. I went every single summer. The Jaws ride, the $6 million man tunnel, and the you know, you could lift up a van. It was just this magical place, Universal, and so that's where we shot it. And to be on that lot, and you could walk to the Psycho House, and you can, you know, do all this stuff. And but it was, you, I walked in that stage, and they had Gotham City built on the stage, streets, paved streets, and sidewalks, and crosswalks and skyscrapers going up into the darkness of the stage and a Central Park type thing with snow and trees. It was
wow.
They don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful, and it was all the art and all the set deck and the art direction was just beautiful. And then we're sitting there, and then the Batmobile comes driving you know, into the stage, up the street, down the middle of Gotham, and it was a magical. That was it. I was like, okay, this is all I'm ever doing for the rest of my life, and you know, so that it was great.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I can keep going on, but one of the ones I'm very eager to talk to you about, and it's funny because the box, the IMDb gives the budget and then the U.S. gross.
Oh.
One of my favorite films. And probably one of my favorite comedies is 1993's Freaked.
Oh, I used to love that movie.
$11 million budget, $29,000 U.S. gross. That was me seeing it over and over and over.
I had the poster in my bedroom because I took it from Blockbuster because it didn't stay up very long, and they gave it away.
Oh, it just spoke to adolescent Ryan with the teenage humor and just Mr. T. Full of – That was just a makeup effects artist's heaven because there's so many creatures there. Mm-hmm. Was there a particular creature that you were responsible for, or were you what?
Again, I worked for XFX, Steve Johnson's XFX at that time, and it was one of my first movies for him. And I was in the shop a lot, seaming and painting a lot of those appliances for Alex Winter.
Okay.
You know, Bill Corso did that makeup on Alex every day, but you know, seaming and painting, the pre-painting those and stuff, and then helping working on the big, I believe it was the Rick monster at the end when he turns into a big giant monster, which was played by Vince Hammond, was in that suit, and just working on all that kind of stuff. Mostly for Steve, we were in charge of the Alex Winter makeup, the Rick monster. Something else I can't remember, but there was a huge, like, a bunch of different companies. Tony Gardner was involved in that. Screaming Man George was involved in that.
Oh, that's so an all-star cast.
What I'm saying. Yeah, it was just like so all hands on deck. We need everybody for this thing.
It was so fun. It was cool to go to set every day too and see everybody's creation. You know, the worm guy's here today. Cool. You know, and then you dog boy's here, and you know, and Alex and his makeup, and the Stewie monster, and the Rick monster, and I. You know, like, oh my God, there's so cool. And that it was just such a weird, and as we were shooting it, it was just so weird fun, but we were laughing our ass off. I had no idea, because we didn't really read the script. You just built stuff and went crazy at that time. You just like, what's some weird shit that we can do that everyone will just think is so strange? And that was the epitome of that movie. Had such a blast. I can't remember. What year was that?
93. Yeah.
One of the other earlier, actually, it's a little bit later in your career, but I want to ask about Virus. Not just because it's an aquatic horror, guys.
From Freak to Virus?
It's like 20 years. That was like 20 years. Okay, fine. I'll ask about Virus in a bit.
Go for Virus.
Well, thanks. I'm intrigued. Because Virus, I mean, the movie, it's had some comebacks now, but I remember being so impressed by the effects at the time period, because it's literally about robots, I think they're aliens, who can take human body parts and turn them into machines. Mm-hmm. And so the majority of the movie is just comprised of these incredible looking effects, which are combined with animatronics.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious about what you had done on it and because there's very original design work in there.
Again,
as well.
That was Steve Johnson, the crazy brilliant mind of Steve Johnson, and working for him, which I value my time with Steve so, so very much, because it really was an outside the box way of thinking of creativity and makeup effects. We never did the same thing twice. You know, it was never the same gag twice, even though the gag was the same. Like, it was like, okay, we got to chop a guy's head off. We've never did it the same twice, and it worked all the time. But it was really, really taught me how to think differently and be crazy with your creativity and makeup effects. And that was all – that movie, as we were building stuff, I worked on a lot of different stuff in there, as we all did. You know, Steve's – that's what was great about working at Steve's, was – you had to know how to do everything. Now it's very compartmentalized. Now people are like, oh, I sculpt at this place, or I just paint at this place, or I do hair at this place. At that time, and because Steve was who he was, and in order to work there, you had to know how to do everything. So you were doing a little bit of sculpting, and then one day you're molding this, and then the other day you're making teeth, and then the next day you're punching hair, and then the next day you're painting this monster. And I remember on that movie specifically having to grommet pieces of muscle and flesh and stretch them across the mechanic, the animatronics that we made, especially for like the Donald Sutherland captain robot thing, which was phenomenal and fantastic. And I remember dressing that thing with muscles and bits of flesh and making it work. We were building the animatronics before we really knew what we were dressing on it as far as flesh goes and character wise. So we had to, you had to figure it out. You know, they were almost fabricated, those things, and they were beautiful pieces of work. I wonder where they're at right now, because they're just gorgeous.
Yeah.
But that was a fun movie. Really hard.
Mm-hmm. And Jamie Lee.
It's the first time I met Jamie Lee. And then she didn't remember me. But when we did reshoots for some Virus in the – and that was another magical part, was at Paramount, you know, they have that that big piece of sky and they flood that area.
The Star Trek 4 thing. Yeah, yeah.
We shot there. Yeah. We shot and they flooded that and we shot there. If I remember right, my memory's really bad.
Yeah, there used to be like a giant tank that was in front of this studio that had like a sky, you know, just a big painted vista, you know. And I think the first time they did that, and I could be completely wrong, film historians, but I remember first reading about it is when the Klingon bird of prey falls into the ocean at the very end of Star Trek IV, and then when Kirk and everybody come out and the wind's blowing and that's just sitting there in the parking lot of Paramount. And every time I walk by there, I get a little
now it's the old
Klingon flu. Your girlfriend would be proud of you for knowing that.
I'm the old school Star Trek guy. She's the next gen.
Yeah, but now it's overflow for parking.
Yeah, but what you know, you talk about the kind of compartmentalization that's occurring. You know, for you over the years in your career, what did you find yourself maybe starting out as and going, that's not real. That's kind of my weak spot. But now you've gotten better at, or has, you know, I'm sure it was a learning curve along the way too.
It is. I mean, I'm not as good at things as I'd like to be. There's a lot of things that I'll probably actually get really good at when I'm retiring, I'm going to guess. But, God, I don't know. You know, again, I just try to do, you're worth more the more you can do.
Yeah.
You know, the more versatile you are. I think makeup, developing paint schemes and making things look organic and real and doing makeup, applying makeup, working with actors and directors and how to shoot things and stuff. I think that's my strong point. I think that's what I thrive at. And I love it because I love collaboration. I'm not one of those guys that goes – that needs all the credit or needs to do everything myself, even though I have to do everything myself. I just love collaboration. I like collaborating with other creative people because I think the end product you get is just better, you know. And there's no reason why if you're all going to the same direction, you can't all go together and really be proud of something. I don't think any one person needs to take all that. So that's why I love, again, doing makeups and working with actors and creating characters and directors and how do we shoot this and going back to Halloween, you know, David was great on that movie and so was Michael Simmons. They were like, Chris, how do we shoot this? What's the best way to look at this? You know, and that was really not only flattering, but it's rare these days. It used to be makeup effects guys really dictated how things were shot. You know, guys like Rob Bottin and Rick Baker and those guys, they knew how to shoot that stuff. And how to make it look real. And I think that's something that's kind of lacking now, both in trust from the filmmakers and also the ability from the makeup effects guys. So I think that I'd like to see that come back more.
Yeah.
You talked quite a bit about working with Steve Johnson, but you know, you work with so many of the classic guys over the years and your peers, your contemporaries, Rick Baker, Steve Johnson, K&B. I don't know, who do you think – I mean, maybe Steve's the answer, but who – who do you think taught you the most valuable lesson or helped you grow the most? Was it, you know, was it Steve Johnson? Was it the K&B guys? Like, what did you learn from your peers?
I think a little bit of everything from all of them. You know, you can learn something from everybody. And that's, again, I know it sounds like a boring answer, but it's just, you know, everybody's got something to teach, man. Steve was great about thinking outside the box and being crazy and doing things weird. K&B was a study in getting it done, efficiency, you know, and still having fun with it. You know, K&B was a fun place to work because those guys love makeup effects, you know, and that brought that back, less of a technical aspect at that point. And Rick Baker, I learned how to be very precise and clean and really think things through from beginning to end before you even start a project and really being good at your craft, like mastering it and trying to master it. And so you learn something from everybody, you know, and I'm a mutt from all those guys, you know.
You had a couple or three films, I think, with Brian Yuzna. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did you ever
have
any?
Which three? I don't remember.
I know you got Necronomicon, which is one of them. Yeah. Talking about The Dentist. Yeah. And didn't he produce Crying Freeman? I think he produced Crying Freeman.
Produced four.
Oh, four.
Return of the Living Dead 3.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, which is huge for us, like that, when we were kids as well. Mm-hmm. But did you ever have any time with Screaming Mad George on any crossover there? Or was
No. You know what? I interviewed for him once. Uh-huh. And I think the movie that I interviewed for him fell through, like it didn't happen. So I never ended up working with him or for him. I wanted to because I heard so many crazy things.
Yeah, because obviously society is just so bad. But with Yuzna, like his strength as a filmmaker to me was always just that it seems like he entrusted a lot with his makeup guys. Like it seems like all of his movies, my favorite thing is the way things look in the makeup, not the performances, not really the story. What was that? What's he like as a collaborator for that?
He's great. I remember Return of the Living Dead 3 because it was me doing some stuff for that, Steve Johnson doing stuff, Kevin Brennan, and Wayne Toth. I believe those were the four. And Tim Ralston did some mechanical stuff. That was a guy that just knew what he wanted. Again, a horror fan who was just like, you know, and I want him to be like this and I want it to be like that. And he's just a very passionate guy, you know, and you have to interpret a lot of what he's saying because you're like, okay, because it was all sound effects, I think I remember. But it was go do your makeup effect thing because he's a fan. Obviously, of makeup effects and practical effects, and that's why his movies are filled with them, you know, but also very surreal and kind of, yeah.
Yeah, surreal. I think that's interesting about his work. He seems like a surrealist at heart,
especially
society, obviously, you know,
yeah.
How far they push that.
Yeah.
There's this other film we've been talking about for years on our show. Anytime werewolves come up, I've always told people my favorite attack scene of all time is the Bad Moon scene in the tent where they're making love and this werewolf comes. I mean, there's multiple scenes in that I just think are incredible. What role did you have in that?
I helped build that werewolf at Steve's again. And
was that an animatronic or what is it?
It was a guy in a suit.
Oh, it was a guy in a suit.
Well, we had different versions. We had a guy in a suit and we had a puppet head and we had this. And I remember building there's a part in the movie, I had to build it really fast. What I remember about that movie was there's a guy with a helmet on. He's like a forest guy or something. He's walking through the woods at night and he goes up against a tree and the werewolf comes down and bites through the his
hard helmet. Yeah, yeah.
And into his head. I built that whole gag. I built everything in that gag in like a week. Steve was like, here's this fucking guy and he bites through the helmet. Oh, and by the way, he's wearing a helmet, so that's got to shatter too. He's biting through the helmet, so hurry up and fucking make that and we'll fucking butt up. And you're like, oh, okay. Sorry, Steve, that was a bad impression. I can actually do better.
It was actually pretty apt. It worked.
I think it was Ken Kersinger that was in the werewolf suit for that movie, wasn't it? The guy that played Jason
Frank. Yeah, he was the werewolf.
Because he's on the Blu-ray, I think. Maybe.
It was going to be the first blonde werewolf. Steve wanted it blonde with pink skin.
Well, he's kind of white, right? He's
kind of like me.
Yeah.
Actually, he wanted, And everyone was like, what the hell is, why did we have a blonde werewolf? And then we ended up changing it, I think, darkening the hair and stuff, because you should have seen it when it was done. It was like this blonde. It was like me, like, but a werewolf. It was weird. Yeah, it wasn't pretty. I built that gag, had to build this fake head that crushed and bled with a helmet that was made of breakaway wax. So I had to mold this helmet and then slush wax in it. And then I had to make the werewolf scissor puppet head that came down. It was like a big scissor thing in it. And had to open the mouth extra wide to be able to get around the helmet and then crush the helmet and the head at the same time. And it was crazy.
It's pretty awesome.
It was fun.
Yeah, that's an underseen movie. And that must be weird, too.
There's a big fan base.
It is. Yeah. It's growing now. Yeah. But like for a long period because it was so hard to get.
Yeah.
But that must be a weird feeling, too, like because you guys pour yourselves into these amazing moments and then some movies are underseen or underperform and certain things you work so hard on get lost.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
When it first happens in your career, you get really disappointed.
Yeah.
You're like, fuck, man, I worked a month on that thing and it was gorgeous and you don't even see it. It got cut out. You get really upset.
Yeah.
Then you just start getting cynical and jaded. And it happens over and over and you start it looks cool.
Well, let's use this as a platform to turn people onto maybe a job that you did that you wish more people saw. Mm-hmm. What's something that you're really proud of that's underseen?
Wow, I'd have to look at all my credits because I don't know what they are.
It's Ghost Ship.
Which
the opening of Ghost Ship.
By the way,
I saw Ghost Ship.
We think the opening of Ghost Ship is the greatest opening of any horror film.
That's a really good example. That's a
I knew it.
Howard Berger and I did all that stuff.
Did you do when the guy literally like slides in half?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That was the first time we really kind of started digitally augmenting some makeup effects. Not a whole lot, but there's some in that sequence, obviously, as you watch it. But yeah, Howard Berger and I went to Australia. We shot it in Sydney or the Gold Coast. I can't remember. Doesn't matter. And we took a bunch of dummies and a bunch of blood and a bunch of tubing, same way we did Kill Bill. You'd be amazed at how we did Kill Bill, although it might be an old story that you've all heard. But but we just took a bunch of stuff and then built it there based on what they wanted to see, because we didn't really know. It wasn't really clear. So they'd go, well, this shot, we want the wire to go through this woman who's wearing a nightgown, and we want her to like topple. You know, they're dancing. There's one shot where there's a couple dancing, and
she he lifts her torso off of the bottom,
and the guts fall out and stuff. And we built all that stuff pretty much on the spot, like a week or two before we shot it. Wow. And that's a good one. Yeah. Wow, I forgot about that.
We've talked about it a lot.
We used to call it goat shit. Somebody made it.
the Australian accent going goat shit.
Also directed by Steve Beck.
Steve Beck, yes.
What happened to Steve Beck, everybody?
He did good stuff.
Well, what happened to him?
Wait a minute, were you not on that email chain?
Was I? I don't know.
Wait a minute. Oh, wait. You were there.
Yeah, the 13
Oh, my God.
This is going back to the
13 Ghost guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That was an email chain about Steve Beck.
But somebody sent us what Steve Beck's actually up to now. And he's apparently an artist. Yeah, he does like sculptures and fine art.
Is he still in L.A.?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. That deep. I just saw the...
Well,
you mentioned before... on top of effects, having an interest in acting as well, and, you know, growing up with Lon Chaney and stuff like that. So how did you end up in front of the camera most prominently with Tarantino? Like, how did that connection happen?
That's the story I've told 1,000 times. I'm sorry if I'm going to bore anybody. But I was working for K&B. Howard Berger says, hey, we're going to go do the new Tarantino movie. It's called Kill Bill. Some of it shoots in China. Yada, yada, yada. I read the he goes, there's a scene where Uma Thurman runs around and cuts all these guys up, you know, 88 guys, and Quentin wants blood, like blood, like blood, blood, blood. I hadn't read the script yet. I wasn't allowed to or something for some reason as we were building it. And so Howard just said, you know, we just get an arm cut off and it shoots like a geyser. Quentin wants it to shoot like, I'm not kidding you, 50 feet. He goes, the further the better. And I go, are you sure? He's like, no, he wants like Shaw Brothers, you know, like, shh, you know. Yeah. I'm like, okay. So I remember doing the first test of when Sophie Fatale, when Uma cuts her arm off, the first slice in the House of Blue Leaves. I did a test of that in the K&B parking lot, and the shit shot like it was ridiculous. and they loved it, and they were like, yeah, that's what we want. And I was like, okay. And so Howard goes, all right, so let's just start building a bunch of dummies and fire extinguishers and go to China. We didn't pre-build any of that because it was all on these actors over in China that we didn't have access to life cast them or fit them for this. So we made a bunch of generic, like small, medium, large shoulder cuffs, small, medium, large arms, small, medium, large dummies, small, medium, large, and armature wire and blood tubing. And we just packed them all in boxes and went there. And we were only supposed to be there for 2 weeks. We ended up being there 4 months.
Wow.
Because I think that sequence was only supposed to shoot for 2 weeks. And we shot it for 2 months.
Oh, my gosh.
And the other two, we shot a bunch of other stuff. So that one was literally like we'd choreograph a section, like a beginning section, and Quentin go, all right, I want this guy, he's going to come over here and cut this fucking guy's head off, and he's going to swing over and cut this guy's fucking leg off, and then cut this guy's fucking head off. All right, go. And then we'd have like 30, 45 minutes to build it, and Howard Berger and I and Jake McKinnon, who I believe was there too, we would rush off to the side stage, take those three guys that we'd never met, and we'd fit them for a shoulder cuff and an armature wire and a hose that suits this and magnets that held the arm together. And we'd slice the thing and we'd build it right there. And then we'd go shoot it. Action. Boom. Blood shooting. Ridiculous. Drenching the entire set. And then he'd go, cut. All right, great. Fucking. All right. So now then she comes over here. She fucking cuts this guy in half. And, da, 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 da. And we're like, okay. So then you go and build it and do it over and over again. And that went on for a couple months. And I think we went through 450 gallons of blood just for that sequence.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was
– worth it.
That was one of the best experiences I'd ever had in my entire life. But how did I end up in it? Was that the question?
Yeah. Shit. Anyway. But before we go there, you know what? I do want to comment on that scene because obviously I like the two films. Obviously it's been released here as Volume 1, Volume 2. Mm-hmm. But every couple of years, the whole Bloody Affair will pop up and play at the New Beverly, which is the original – one movie cut of it, which is a fucking masterpiece.
I'm still dying to see
And that scene in particular, because in the actual movie volume one, it cuts to black and white. But on The Whole Bloody Affair, it does
stays
not.
In color. Yeah.
And I don't know if my eyes are playing tricks on me, but I'm pretty sure it's even more violent.
It is.
Yeah.
Because there's stuff
it's incredible.
That they cut out for the regular version. There's a lot more stuff.
Yeah.
Going back to what stuff do I wish people had seen, we did a lot of really complicated, insane gags in that sequence that ended up getting cut out in the final theatrical thing that's in that version.
I wish that would come out somehow.
I know.
They
keep saying it will, but you know, they'll wait. Until they do part three, and then which they're going to do, I think, and then I don't know. We'll see.
Well, there you go.
We'll see.
Oh, but how did you get in it?
That's oddly enough, so I was so on the plane to China. I was reading the script. Finally, they let me read it, and I came across that part of Tommy Plimpton, which was Uma's fiance, and I said, I could do that. I go, I could do that role, and I was said that to Howard and. At the time, I had been studying acting on my off time. I went to Beverly Hills Playhouse and studying in various places. And then got to China, did the whole China thing, came back 4 months later. We had a bit of a hiatus to build some stuff before we start shooting the L.A. portion of it. And we had a meeting with Quentin. Me and Greg Nicotero had a meeting. And Howard, I think, was there too. Yeah. And we were like going over the effects of what was coming up. And he goes, well, there's – the groom and he gets his head blown off, so I want to see his head, but it's fucking half of it's fucking gone and da, da. And we were like, well, who's playing that, because we need to life cast him this week in order to get the gag done. And he goes, I don't know who it's going to be, I have a casting session this Friday. And it was Greg Nicotero that goes, Chris is an actor, he's been acting and stuff. And he looks at me, he goes, you're an actor? And I was like, yeah, I'm trying, I've been doing some stuff. He goes, you look like you could be the guy. He goes, but you got to audition because the part's too big. I can't just fucking give it to you. And I was like, okay. I'd love to audition. And he goes, all right, so be there Friday at 3 o'clock. I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm driving home with Greg and Howard going, holy fuck, I have an audition for Quentin Tarantino. I was nervous as fuck. So I drove down the 405, went, did the audition, read it twice, left, drove back up the 405 in traffic going, I don't even care if I don't get this. Just to audition for Quentin Tarantino was pretty fucking cool. Yeah. Just to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
And then we were on set about a week later, and I got called up with some blood. They said, Chris, Quentin needs you with blood. I ran up. He didn't need blood. He goes, oh, I just want you to know that I saw your audition tape, and I've been watching it. And I'm like, oh, here it comes. I was waiting for him to go, and you fucking suck. You should quit. Because he's the kind of guy that would say that. And he just said, he goes, it's really good. He goes, you were really good. He goes, I can't believe it. He goes, so it's down to four people and you're one of the people. And he kept doing that like every day over the next 3 days,
Brutal.
And then finally he went, you're my fucking guy. You're Tommy. You're my guy. And I just couldn't believe it. So that day I went to Canby after rep, had my head cast. The next week I was on set with Sam Jackson and Uma Thurman and Bo Svenson David Carradine, and it was and I was like, how the fuck did I get here? And I remember Howard Berger laughing at me behind the camera before my first take, and Quentin coming up to me going, don't fuck this up.
and then
I did my first couple takes, and David Carradine, I go, David, how am I doing? And he goes, I wouldn't quit your day job.
You got kung fu.
Yeah.
Well, here's the fun thing about your role, because I've seen Bruce Campbell do many Q&As, and anytime somebody starts a question, so that small role and whatever, he's like, well, small? Pivotal role. I'd like to think if you were not in that movie, then Uma Thurman would not felt the need to kill
revenge.
Bill.
Yes.
If she didn't really love you.
You were the most pivotal everything.
Role in I don't that know movie. About that. I think it had a lot to do with him shooting a pregnant woman.
That's true.
But
it was at, the wedding.
That's true. Thanks, man.
Yeah.
A modern one, I'm talking about ones that maybe less people have seen, but that's because it's an indie. I didn't know you made it till just now, but I love this movie of the last, I guess it's 5 years ago now, Honeymoon. I thought that was a fantastic movie. I'm really excited to see what she makes next. But speak a little bit about that, because that has a really – I love the organic textures of that creature design and, kind of an alien, obviously.
And there's a transformation that happens throughout the film where you're gradually watching this kind of
– It's really cool. well done.
Change.
So, I like that movie, you know. I don't really know well if done. Many people do, but I really
like
it.
I just feel like people don't know about it. It's not that they don't like it or not. You know what I mean? I feel like it's just less
it
well
was on Netflix.
It was, I think for a while it had it.
But
it's still there, I think,
That
was a really interesting movie. I don't know how that movie came about. I got a call from Lee, the director, who's a wonderful, wonderful woman and really talented. She's great. And I think I know what her next project is, but I can't say and I won't say it. But it's pretty cool. And she called me for it, so I'm really excited.
Oh, cool.
But it was her first like major thing, and she was great, and she was really adamant about it being very visceral, if that's the right word, and textured and organic, and a lot of it had to do with insect reference and things like that, you know, and she didn't want it to be overly, you know, stylized, but she wanted you to feel it, and so that worked a lot with layers and textures and how to make it kind of more of like a sickness overcoming someone, and so and done for little to no money, you know, that movie. I really did pull a lot of stuff out of the bins and closets and went, okay, how can I use this? How can we make this look good?
And do you still do that because you're just drawn to the material and just want to keep playing? So you're not just taking big jobs where you don't have to do very much that pay really well. You want to keep mixing up what you actually get to do?
You never know what you're going to end up – where opportunities are going to come up, what's going to be good, what's going to be bad. You know, there's making money and making a living, and there's – creatively satisfying yourself and challenging yourself. And I think it's never been about big movies, small movies. It's never really been about that for me. It's just been about working on movies. I mean, I did a lot of television there for a block, and I was never really into television that much, but then television changed, you know, and has become so cinematic now. And so I do like working on some shows like that, but
yeah, you're still doing American Horror Story, right? Mm-hmm. You did the last season with the whole stuff.
I worked on that one, yeah. Very I contributed cool. to that stuff. The Cult, it's called, Worked the first four seasons and then took a break and did Suicide Squad because I was dumb to – that was the time I was like, I want to go back to movies. I love movies. So I stopped working on Horror Story and went and my first movie after that was Suicide Squad.
Which you won an Academy Award for.
I don't know how that happened.
Academy voters just love that Killer Croc and your menagerie of weirdos.
Well, yeah. I love that makeup for Killer Croc because it shows that, hey, Spider-Man, you could have done the lizard practically.
Yeah.
You know?
We did. I worked on that Spider-Man and we did do a practical makeup on Reese Iphens, right?
Yeah.
Who played?
That's right.
We did do a practical makeup on him.
And they decided not to use it?
Yeah, I guess.
It's a bummer.
I mean, it wasn't a full-blown one. It was like a mid-transformation thing that was like asymmetrical and it looked really cool. But for whatever reason, we never saw it. Whatever. There's one that we never saw. So, but
what about doing a lot of going back and forth between, you know, low-budget independent movies and horror, but superheroes? Because you are definitely in the Marvel world quite a bit and DC with that. But you grew up a comic book guy? Because
I did.
Yeah, to me, it's got to be exciting to work not only on Michael Myers, but then some of these Avengers characters and things like that.
I was a huge comic book fan and superheroes. I watched Super Friends every day.
I love Super Friends.
And as lame as that was.
I love this. And
it wasn't lame when we were kids.
Well, you know, the Wonder monkey. Twins with the monkey thing. I was a huge comic book fan. And I used to watch The Incredible Hulk with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno religiously in the $6 million. Oh, man, he's not a superhero. He was to me. And Kiss, who were superheroes of rock. But The Incredible Hulk. And I never thought it would, you know, no one ever thought that movies would be what they are now.
Yeah.
You know, with that kind of stuff. And but it's fun to work on those. I owe a lot to those kind of movies. And I'm grateful having worked on them, but I, you know, enjoy. And I didn't get to do a lot of horror. More, I wanted to do more horror stuff in my career. I think that's one thing. I mean, I've done a bit, but I wanted to do more. you know, horror stuff. But the superhero movies are fine, and they're really cool, and some of them are great. I didn't mind Suicide Squad. I think, you know, people really bash on it a lot. I didn't think it was as bad as it turned out to be. We shot a different movie than what came out. You know, David had a different intention with that movie, and I've seen some of that stuff, and it's really cool. I wish that movie came out, but it didn't. And I didn't think Justice League was that bad. You know, I like the dark DC universe. I prefer dark rather than the big bright stuff. But it's all, you know, it's all the same.
I was going to ask, did you see a creative difference between how Marvel operates and how they translate their superheroes and their, you know, monsters to screen versus how the DC process works? Did you, in terms of, because you're there on the front lines, you know, presenting how you're going to bring these things to screen. So I'm sure you're presenting it to an array of executives who all have something to say. And I'm just curious to see if DC operates in a little bit differently than Marvel.
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think Marvel, I think, really focuses on their aesthetics and their visual, making sure that's perfect and right and exactly fits into their universe. And then they work on the story and making sure that, you know, it's gonna look like this, and then this is what it's about. Whereas DC, I think, kind of has a hard time doing that, separating those two things and really. But ultimately, I think what all those movies I feel lack is a really great story that pulls you in and makes you care about somebody or something. I mean, if everybody's a superhero and can't get hurt, then there's nothing to lose.
No stakes.
You know,
you're
kind of like, oh, all right, well, I know he's going to come back. And, you know, I really like drama and tragedy, you know, and comedy. So story. So I'd say the difference between those two are, you know, story, how you approach telling a story.
I was going to say, because of how heavy those films are on CG and computer graphics and things like that, did along the way, did you adapt to that side of the business too? Because, you know, I know a lot of the somebody like Tom Savini, whose work I respect, never really got into the computer side of things, you know, like evolving from that. Whereas I know Rick Baker, like, really was an early advocate of Photoshop and figuring things out on a computer first before
still is
delving in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, have you evolved along with that and dabbled?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to.
Yeah.
You have to. I mean, it's like anything in the movie business. When something new comes along that is super fantabulous and wonderful, everyone thinks it's the end of something else.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, that's it. No more makeup effects. CG's here and everyone just go home. Yeah. And then they realize that you can't really do everything. And then audiences catch up and kind of get tired, and they realize that they can't, you know, they're like, well, another CG monster and another CG this and another, not that there's anything wrong with it and they look beautiful, but I think audiences catch up.
Yeah.
And then I think the movies, filmmakers catch up and they realize, oh, wait a minute, it doesn't always have to be all of this or all of that. We can combine the two, collaborate, and come up with a better product that helps tell our story, that audiences will believe and fall in love with. And, you know, it always takes time. You know, it's always a 3D. 3D was
–
how many times has 3D come back? And it was the –
1983.
You know, that's it. Everything's going to be in 3D. So, I try to stay on top of all that stuff. I mean, I'd rather work with a digital artist and visual effects guy like we do on Horror Story, where, you know, you do this really awesome makeup, but you're painting the nose green and part of the jaw green, and they go in and they remove it. And like Walking Dead does it a lot. And, you know, when you work together, you get some really fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way to go.
Yeah.
Is there anything you haven't gotten to do yet? Because you're talking about, like, you wish you could do more horror, and I'm seeing, like, some Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein, like, creating a great, like, classic monster.
Yeah.
Is there something you just haven't gotten to do in your career
that
you're itching? Okay. So I read your tattoos correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of my powers, is to read a man's tattoos.
Yeah, create.
It doesn't do me much
that's
good.
That's one of your powers? Just a man's tattoo?
It's just a man. Just I don't know what it is. It just doesn't work on women.
That's really weird.
Yeah, I know. It sucks.
No. I would like to create someday. I mean, it's every makeup artist's dream to create an iconic creature, you know, creation character that will live forever in cinema.
Of course, a Halloween mask is a good step towards
that. Yeah, I was going to say, I think you've come pretty close to that.
Because that's our generation's Frankenstein when you think about it. That's as close as we get to that, I think. So,
Freddy, Jason.
But I think it's that mask that's the closest to Frankenstein. Yeah. I don't know why. It just seems to me. You know?
Well, I wish I could take credit for creating Michael Myers. But look, you can. I'm just trying to get back to it. I'd like to do that. I wish I could do that. Dark Universe was a Dark Universe. The Universe was Dark Universe.
Yeah,
we're going to do Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein.
Was do Bride, which would have been cool.
I wanted to do that so bad. Yeah. Like I was like, how do I get that?
Yeah,
you know,
and but Creature.
Then that all went away.
Yeah.
What happened to that?
It all went away.
Yeah, Ryan.
They decided to do a Bride of Frankenstein movie before a Frankenstein movie. So
they're heading towards action film versions of them, which I think is where it was a mistake. You know, maybe it'll recalibrate.
They lost the whole gothic telling of awesome classic literature.
That worked so well.
What? Obviously, you had a great experience on Bright. What is Bright 2 on the horizon?
Bright 2. Yeah. I just got an email about Bright 2.
Yeah,
a couple days ago.
Yeah.
What? I could say that.
It's already on IMDb.
I'm not going to say what it's about. I don't know what it's about. I don't know exactly when it's happening. It's happening soon. I know there is going to be a Bright 2, and I believe they want to expand the world of it. And it did really well.
Chris,
we're going to make it global.
Yeah, explain to me. I mean, and this is it might be a sensitive subject, but I remember when Bright came out, there was something about a credit issue. And I saw a lot of people trying to wrap their heads around, what's the big deal? But there were a lot of, what was the exact thing? They didn't give credit to the entire team. What was the?
It had nothing to do with my makeup team.
Right.
It had to do with ADI, Amalgamated Dynamics shop, who built a lot of the stuff.
Right.
Their entire crew didn't get screen credit that they submitted, I believe. Isn't that what happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so. A lot of that crew, and there was a lot of people because it was a big show.
Yeah,
you know, so a lot of those people didn't get credit, and I believe Netflix corrected that. They put a thing in there.
Yeah. And slipped something new into the credit.
Yeah, they fixed the credits.
Why do uncredited? Because I also looking through, I see like some of my favorite movies, like Jarmusch's Dead Man or Magnolia. There's often these uncredited roles that are credited years later on IMDb. Why does that exist? Why are some people is it just because you're so less involved overall? Like you just came on for a day. Why do those kind of credits exist?
Actually, no. There's a lot of people that don't get credit that work for months on movies and years on movies that don't get credit. Not sure why that happens. It's always been a mystery. I think someone explained it to me once. A producer explained it to me once. It's something about running time. Huh. The end credits are included in the runtime of a movie. Mm-hmm. Like when you see a movie and it says runtime, 1 hour, 42 minutes. Well, 10 minutes of that, or however long your credits roll, are part of that runtime. And I think that has something to do with money or budget. I don't know what the deal, the way I want to find out, but it had something to do with that. Mm. And so they shorten credits to make the runtime shorter. For whatever reason, I don't know. You're a producer.
I think this guy was giving you some sassafras. I don't know. Or it might be a union thing, or it might be. I mean, maybe. Like I've never heard of runtime affecting someone's credit. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I heard it costs money or something. You get all kinds of answers because you're always getting excluded in credits. I can't even count how many movies I worked on. I'm not in credits because a lot of people that I know, you know. I don't know what that is.
Did you do the Frogs of Magnolia?
I worked on the Frogs of Magnolia. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I got to say
that's a great Steve Johnson story in his autobiography about
it. Oh, I've heard that. Yeah. That's one of those moments in a movie like where something so surprising happens that no planet could you have prepared yourself for that moment. I love that in movies. I love
Paul Thomas Anderson. Oh, yeah, he's super
the best,
cool. And ended up in Inherent Vice.
He did?
I was in Inherent Vice and he called me himself and asked me to come and do it. I was in New Orleans on American Horror Story shooting Coven. Was it Coven?
Yeah.
Why are you laughing?
Or it's Coven like over.
My girlfriend's laughing. I don't know. But he's awesome. And I love that movie. I think Magnolia is one of his best movies.
I think it's so cool.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it since moving to LA. I feel like it must be a fun movie to watch once you're here again.
Yeah. The other movie that nobody saw or really likes that I'm really proud of that I worked for Steve Johnson on was Bicentennial Man.
Oh, wow.
I don't think that's such a bad – I mean, it's very sweet and saccharine and stuff like that, but that robot suit's badass.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of really cool stuff in that movie that we did.
Yeah, I get it.
Well, I'm happy to say because I didn't realize it was on the IMDb, but you'll be able to see Chris in Halloween as well.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, that was
awesome. Are we allowed to say that?
It's on IMDb.
Is it?
Yeah.
I didn't put it on there. Yeah.
Officer Francis, is this a pivotal role?
The whole movie based on Officer Francis.
That's where we'll stop. Chris, thank you so much for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for having me. It was awesome to be here.
A lot of fun.
All right.